This is Richard Verone, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. John Hargesheimer. Today is May 5th, 2003. It's approximately 3:12 p.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library in the interview room. Mr. Hargesheimer, you are in Sellersburg, Indiana. And, sir, let's get started with a brief biographical sketch of yourself. Could you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about where you grew up in your childhood?
Sure. I was born in Jeffersonville, Indiana, which is the county seat of Clark County. That's where I live right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm living in the same house I grew up in.
Wow.
So I've lived in this house for over, off and on for over 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Speed, Indiana, which is really Sellersburg, Indiana, but when I was growing up, there was a little community called Speed, which is named after a cement plant
mm-hmm.
that most of the men around here worked in, like my father and all the older men around here worked at that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a small community, about 10 miles north of Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay.
So.
When were you born?
January 2nd, 1947.
Okay. And tell me, what do you remember about growing up as a young boy?
Oh, how much fun it was around here, because we had a lot of freedom, because it was mostly rural back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of, I didn't have any brothers, but I had a lot of cousins and a lot of friends right around this area. And we'd all go out and, swim in the creeks and the ponds, and that's how we all learned to swim, is the mm-hmm. rock quarries, a lot of rock quarries around here, because of the cement plant. There's a lot of limestone, so there's quarries all over the place. So you do have to be careful, because
mm-hmm.
every once in a while somebody drowned in those things.
Mm-hmm.
But, we hunted, fished, just everything like that. Worked
okay.
on the farms.
Okay. So you had no siblings?
I have a sister. Older sister.
Okay, one older sister. How about your folks? Tell me about your parents.
My father was named John Hargesheimer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born, in fact, about, I could see the house from that he was born in from my house.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in that one, and they moved to the big city up in Sellersburg, which is a mile up the road,
mm-hmm.
and they moved there, and so he had seven sisters, so I had a lot of aunts and uncles on that side, and then my mother is from Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
and then when they married, she moved up here, and my father died when I was 10 years old mm-hmm. in an industrial accident. And so it left my mother to take care of the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, she had. That's one of the reasons why. I was really close to her naturally,
mm-hmm.
because she had a rough way to go.
Right. What did she do for a living?
Well, when my father died, she was she was just a housewife. And
okay.
Luckily, one of my uncles was a trustee at the school,
mm-hmm.
school trustee, which had. Back then, that would be like a superintendent now.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to get her on as a teacher's aide. So she worked as a teacher's aide after my father died and ended up being the teacher, kindergarten teacher. And then she did that in the daytime. And then at night, she worked over at the powder plant, which is an Indiana Army ammunition plant,
mm-hmm.
which is in Charlestown, Indiana, which is just about 7 miles from here. And they produce gunpowder for all the military.
Okay.
So she was working two jobs.
Okay.
So
did that last all the way through high school for you?
Pretty much, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She was a hard worker. That's one thing I found out about.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, she was a good person. So she took care of made sure my sister made it through college.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the Marine Corps.
Well, did you and your sister work when you were growing up?
My sister didn't do too much.
Okay.
It wasn't her idea. It was just the way my mother was. The men did the work and the women didn't.
Okay.
And so my sister didn't have to do much work. I did. I worked all the time. I always worked on the farms and delivered papers and worked odd jobs all over the place, any place I could get.
Mm-hmm.
But, that was just the way it was.
What job do you remember most?
Work putting up hay.
Oh,
was
yeah.
Terrible.
Tell me about that.
It was really hard work, especially down here. It's really humid. Right in this area, it's extremely humid
mm-hmm.
in the summer. So usually around July or August when the hay comes in, we'd have to put it up, and so it'd be extremely hot. That and cleaning out chicken houses. That was one of the things a lot of us guys did around here.
Mm-hmm.
We had to, you had to clean all the crap out of the chicken houses, and it was just like sticking your nose in an ammonia bottle. And then you had to really be careful because if you made too much noise, chickens are prone to, they'll panic real easy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you made too much noise or a sudden move, then they would all panic and jump on, pile up on top of each other and kill each other. So we had to really be careful about that.
Wow.
So it was interesting.
Okay.
Then in paper routes, and that was, had a morning route. I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and ride bicycle. I think it was like 7 miles delivering papers. And then I'd go to school and pass out. Fall asleep in school.
Tell me about your school experience.
I went to a little school called Silver Creek High School. I went to Stout Elementary, which is named after a little elderly teacher. And Stout Elementary, and it was a nice little school, probably about a couple of hundred kids in there. And it was just a typical rural little school. And then from there I went to the junior high and the high school, Silver Creek Junior High and High School. There was probably 500 or 600 there. I think 3 or 4 schools fed into it, elementary schools. And it was just a nice little rural school. It's still there. And, in fact, my daughter went there, graduated from there. And that's where I met my wife. Met her in junior high, and never dated her or anything until I got out of the Marine Corps. But we knew, we'd known each other since we were about 12 years old.
What kind of student were you?
Not the greatest. I had no desire to ever go to college. And since my mother worked so much, I was pretty much on my own. Now, my sister was really good student, which kind of, you know, in a way it put pressure on me if I wanted it to live up to her standard because she was older. And so they would look at, after having her, then when I got there, they expected a whole lot out of me. And so I sort of disappointed. But, no, I could have. It's just one of those deals. I wanted to be in the military, and back then you didn't even have to have a high school diploma to get a degree or to get to go in. And so if it wasn't for my mother, I'd have quit school and joined the Navy right off the bat.
Okay.
As soon as I was 16, I would have quit, and then 17, I would have joined the Navy.
Are you glad you stayed in high school?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What were your favorite subjects, if you had any?
Oh, history. I'm extremely a history buff. So my poor wife, when she walks in the room, I'd be watching the History Channel. She just turns around and walks out. But, yeah, history and industrial arts shop, naturally. And anything like that, agriculture, like the egg, took egg classes, stuff like that. But, no, the academics, I could really care less. It's terrible to say as being a teacher. But I just had no desire to do it.
How about sports?
Sports, no, I was working most of the time.
Okay.
I just didn't have the time to do it. I played a little baseball until I got racked up and they got hit pretty good with a line drive, and this is not for me. So, no, that was it. I ran a little cross-country, but no, most of the time I was out working.
Okay. Tell me about why you wanted to join the military. Was there a military experience in your family?
Well, I had a lot of uncles that were in, and most of the men around here, my father was, and most of the men here around this area that I grew up with were World War II vets. So I grew up listening to that. Plus, oh, about that time, John Kennedy, President Kennedy, and I still remember him, you know, that great speech he said, ask not what you can do, what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Yes, sir.
And being a young guy, that was pretty inspirational. And he had been in the Navy, and so he knew, you know, that meant a lot to me. And I always looked up to all veterans, just always looked up to them. And grew up watching John Wayne on the movies and stuff like that. And so I always wanted to join the Navy, and that was my goal, because one of my best uncles was, my favorite uncle was in the Navy, and he'd always tell me about all these great stories. So I that's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
But instead, I ended up joining the Marine Corps, and I have no regrets, that's for sure. But,
right. How many, or excuse me, what year did you graduate high school?
Yeah, 1965.
Okay. Did you know, you know, upon graduation in 65, what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia? Were you aware of that?
Yeah, by that time ahead. I remember sitting in class, still remember sitting in a class, I think it was a government or civics class, and my one of my teachers, an old World War II vet, mm-hmm. he pulls down a map and points at this little old world map and points at this little spot there in, the, in Asia somewhere, and he said, and he looks at all of us guys in there, and he tells us, says, boys, said, that's going to be the next hot spot. That's Vietnam. He said, a lot of you guys are going to be there. And we thought he was crazy. Mm-hmm. We had no idea what he was talking about. We were squinting on trying to find it on the map. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, 2 years later, sitting in the middle of it.
Right. Did you remember back to that moment when he had said that?
Yes, I sure did. I sure did.
Okay.
But he was a nice guy. We thought he was crazy. And so at that time, I knew about it, and I was always reading the papers and Life magazine. I was always having big, Life and Look magazine was always having big pictorials
mm-hmm.
On the Vietnam, and so I'd go in the library and look at that. And that's one of the reasons why I joined the Marines instead of the Navy, because it's crazy to sound, I wanted to see what it was actually like, and I knew if I was in the Navy, I would probably end up sitting off on a ship offshore.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's not being in the war. Now, World War II, yeah, that would have been, you know, Navy did a lot in World War II, but in Vietnam, except for the corpsmen, the chaplains, and all the guys that was with the Marines, and the guys down in the Delta, mm-hmm. And the Seabees, mostly Navy guys sat offshore, and that just wasn't for me, sitting on a ship. And I wanted to be on the ground, and I wanted to see, and of course, I was kept reading, and the Marines were really catching it, and I thought, well, here you go, bud. So I thought, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go with them. To me, they were the best.
Why did you think that?
Because they were drafting so much. Now, in my class, there was 60... I think it was about 60 or 62 boys in my class graduating high school class. Over 50 of us were in the service.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost expected, unless you were extremely intelligent and lucky enough to go to college. Well, really, even if I could have, I probably would have gone then.
Mm-hmm.
But you went into service. It's just part of life. Mm-hmm. You went in, just a matter of what branch. I didn't really want to go in the Army because everybody... You know, everybody went in the Army,
mm-hmm.
and very few people that I knew went in the Marine Corps. And they always had the reputation of having the toughest boot camp and the biggest challenge, the mm-hmm. meanest drill instructors. And I thought, I'm going to try it. You know, I figured if anybody thinks those guys can do it, I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to try it and see.
What did your mother think?
She wasn't real happy. But she never said no. And of course, I went and joined, then I told her.
Right.
But she knew I was going to go in. It was just a matter of what branch. And I didn't want to wait around to be drafted. I was just waiting around, just wasn't getting it. And it was hard to get a job back then if you hadn't been in, because so many guys were getting drafted. And a lot of places didn't want to hire you because they knew if they hired you, then you'd probably get drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they trained you.
Right.
So it might as well go in and get it over with, and that's the one I wanted.
Okay. Well, when did you actually enlist? What date?
It would have been the actual date, I'm not sure. It was in March. I think it was like March 28th when I went to boot camp,
okay.
Buffer boot camp in 1966.
Okay, in 66 when you got in. Okay.
Right.
Well, go ahead and tell me about your basic training at Parris Island.
Joined up in Louisville, Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
and we went to Parris Island. Now, some of the guys... If you depend on what time, when you joined, as to whether you went to San Diego or Parris Island. I never even knew San Diego was a Marine boot camp until I went and saw a recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
I always grew up thinking Parris Island.
Right.
Yeah, it's the one I was, you know, Jack Webb and all that.
Right.
And that's the only one I ever heard of until I got to the solid recruiter. And so I told him, he asked me which one I wanted to go to. I said, well, I want to go to Parris Island. To me, that's the only one there is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they sent me. And so we all went to the hospital over here in Louisville, And it was where all the branches of the service, and then you got sworn in, and all the branches of the service took their physicals and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it there weren't very many Marines going in. A lot of Army guys, naturally,
mm-hmm.
and Navy and Air Force. But it was funny because they started drafting into the Marine Corps about that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another reason why I wanted to join the Marines, because it was basically volunteer.
Right.
And I liked that idea of all volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, if you had guys, most that way you wouldn't have guys in there that didn't want to be there. But if you volunteer, then more than likely you wanted to be in that outfit.
Right.
So I thought the motivation and the spirit of corps would be a little bit higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
So they started drafting. It was funny because we would watch these poor guys. They'd take all these guys that were getting drafted, and they would, there might be 20 of them there, and they would have them stand them in a line, and they would have them count off by numbers, like 1 through 5, 1 through 5, and then they say, okay, all the number twos step forward.
Mm-hmm.
They step forward, and here come a big old Marine come out there, and they said, you are now in the Marine Corps. And these guys would just, some of them would actually cry.
Really?
Right. It was to us, it was funny, because we had joined,
mm-hmm.
and these guys, they didn't need to be laughing at us, because they thought we were crazy enough to join the Marine Corps.
This was in Louisville?
Yeah, this was in Louisville,
okay.
Kentucky. And so you had all these, a lot of these country boys from down in Kentucky went up there. And some of these guys were just almost in tears when they found out. But it turned out to be, we had a lot of draftees in my platoon at Parris Island, and it turned out to be, most of them were really good,
mm-hmm.
really gung-ho.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good. But I left Louisville. We all left on the first time I ever flew a plane flew Eastern Airlines down to Charleston, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And the Marine Corps has a way when you go to boot camp, they want you to get there to arrive at the boot camp. They did then about like midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So you get in the bus, hop on a bus at Trailways bus from the airport, and they take you down to Parris Island. And when you get there, it's pitch dark, and you know you're scared to death anyway. Everybody, and you got a lot of these guys got long hair, and still back in the times with the hippies and stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
saw a lot of long hair guys on there, and they weren't smart enough to cut their hair
mm-hmm.
before they got there. And so they pull up in front of the barracks, and here come a couple of DIs, drill instructors. Of course, you didn't call them DIs, you call them drill instructors.
Mm-hmm.
And they come screaming on there, and the first two or three, the first guys and the first two seats, the front two seats,
mm-hmm.
they just grabbed them, punched them in the stomach real hard, and threw them out the door.
Wow.
And that was our introduction. They just kept screaming. And I thought, oh, my God. This is the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, and then from there, it was interesting. On in. And you went out, and you had the little footprints on the deck. And the yellow footprints, and you lined up in that. And even the guys that got punched, they were the first ones, so they had to stagger up and get in formation. And
mm-hmm.
and they took you over and cut your hair and gave you, you had to strip down. They gave you your new utilities and all your gear and all that stuff. And basically, it was just pure chaos.
Right.
For the first 18, 20 hours. And you just look like a herd, look like a mob. And then they started training, and the training began. It was interesting. It was very good training. I can't complain.
What was your typical day like?
Typical day started about 4:30 in the morning. And you got up, and you did, first thing you did was, let's see, I'm trying to remember. First thing you did was go brush your teeth, and they gave you like a minute and a half to go relieve yourself and brush your teeth and all this other stuff, do everything you had to do. And then you went back and got in formation in the barracks, and then you ran out and you ran, oh, 2 or 3 miles before you would even begin to think about going to chow.
Mm-hmm.
You put on your shoes and all, and then you came back and you made your bunk. And if you didn't, of course, you had bunk inspection, and if that didn't work, then they would tear your bunk apart, throw everything on the deck, and you start all over after they work. I don't want to say they beat you, but they would physically do things to you. They would hit you, and they wouldn't sit there and just beat on you, but they would mm-hmm. do things to you that weren't good. And
Where would they hit you, basically?
Usually in the stomach or someplace where it wouldn't show.
Right.
Sometimes they would hit you in the head, but most times it was around the stomach or mm-hmm. back or kidneys or someplace.
Right.
But and you know, you knew that before you went in. So if you were, like I say, if you're so naive that you didn't think this was going to be hell before you went in, God, I don't know where you were, because that was just always a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't anything I wasn't expecting, but it wasn't fun, but it wasn't anything I wasn't expecting. So it didn't surprise me. The relentless, you know, just constant. Now that's, I just couldn't believe how much they just, from sun up to sun down, they were just constantly on you.
Mm-hmm.
But it was for a purpose. You know, it definitely motivated you. And they try to break you down from being an individual, a civilian individual, to a military team member. And they mm-hmm. try to break you down, just completely break you down, mentally and physically,
mm-hmm.
Down to zero almost. And then they try to build you up, and then they start molding you. So it had a good purpose, and I knew that. And so, you know, they wanted you to be a Marine and part of a team.
Right.
And they wanted you to be able to do that. And so they just physically, they tried to weed you out. They were trying to weed the weak out, basically, there at the beginning. So they really made it rough on you. And some guys literally cracked up. They couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the drill instructor, for some reason or other, didn't like you, God forbid, if you managed to, you know, cross them, it could really make it rough. And one of the things back then, if they could put you, like say you were in boot camp, our boot camp was 10 weeks long, and they cut it short 2 weeks because of the war. And so they wanted to get more guys out there quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were like in your sixth or seventh week, and for some reason or other they didn't think you were where you should be, they could send you back and start you all over again.
Wow.
And I knew guys that were there for several, like 9 months, never mm-hmm. got out of Paris Island.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd get these guys in, and of course, by that time, these guys are so screwed up. You know, back then, they didn't kick you out as quick as they do now.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't do it. They tried to keep you in. They would just screw with you if they didn't like you. And I tell you, back then, it seemed like the worst ones that they really picked on the most were the Jewish boys.
Really?
Yeah. For some reason or other, the Jewish boys, there weren't that many Jewish guys in the service anyway, and the ones that were usually from like New York or New Jersey or someplace. And a lot of them, I guess they thought of them as mama's boys.
Mm-hmm.
They just were usually out of shape guys. They just weren't real physical. And what changed the whole attitude, I think, of the Marine Corps about the Jewish guys was the Six-Day War.
Right.
And after that, I've never heard of another derogatory term about towards the Jews after that.
Right.
Before that, they just seemed to be the whipping boys. When they get a kid in there that was a Jewish kid, they just literally went after the kid relentlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And but after the Six-Day War, when the Jewish guys, when Israel kicked butt
mm-hmm.
in 6 days, that really changed everybody's attitude towards them. I never had a problem one way or the other with them, you know. Being from where I'm at, I never even knew anyone.
Right.
But it just seemed like the poor Jewish guys really caught it.
Now, what kind of training did you receive? This is basic boots. It's a lot of physical. Any classroom?
Classroom. Now, they cut out some of the classroom. That was one of the things they cut out because of the war. It's always kind of funny to me. During war, they cut the boot camp is shorter. And during peacetime, boot camp is longer, so you get more training in
mm-hmm.
peacetime,
mm-hmm.
which to me ought to be just the opposite. You ought to get more training in wartime. But they cut out a lot of the academic stuff, and we had to memorize everything. Bad thing about being in the Marine Corps, you had to know all the ranks. You
mm-hmm.
had to know Marine Corps rank, plus you had to know Navy rank.
Mm-hmm.
And the Navy rank's completely different than the Marine Corps, so it was hard enough trying to figure out the Marine Corps.
Right.
Then we had to figure out what, you know, what was the equivalent in the Navy, so we had to learn both of those. And, of course, you had to know the history of the Marine Corps and things like that, basically military history.
Right.
But and then the evolution of the weapons and all that stuff, how they came up, got up. And we practiced with the M14s.
Mm-hmm.
The M1s had just gotten phased out And when I got out of boot camp and went to ITR up at Camp Lejeune, we used a lot of M1s, but basically we trained with M14s.
How were you on the M14?
I wasn't the worst shot in the world, but I wasn't the greatest. It was just I was a good shot. I was raised with weapons, mm-hmm. but never heavy caliber like that. But no, I was a pretty good shot.
Okay.
I can't complain. I'd never been a sniper, but I was a good shot with it.
Okay.
I enjoyed shooting. I loved shooting, still do. So,
what was the hardest thing about boot camp?
The mental part. The physical part never really bothered me. I was skinny, wiry. I could run for miles.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, being worked on farms all my life, I was pretty good shape. So that wasn't the part. It was the mental part. It was the constant mental,
mm-hmm.
The screaming and getting into mindset. But really, once I got used to that, it wasn't that hard.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of funny about the smoking. If you were a smoker, which I was at the time,
mm-hmm.
You after each meal, it depended on the drill instructors if they wanted to let you smoke. And if you didn't smoke, there was two groups, the smokers and non-smokers. The
mm-hmm.
smokers, they would come out, the drill instructor would say the smoking lamp is lit. So all the smokers, one guy would grab a bucket, a pail,
mm-hmm.
and run into the head or the restroom and fill it about half full of water. And then we'd all march, and he'd come back out and arrest me. You'd grab your cigarette, and you would go out and stand in a circle behind the barracks. And you stand out facing outboard. Yeah, it's facing. You put the bucket right in the center,
mm-hmm.
and then they say, and then they would come out and they say the smoking lamp is lit. And then you, at attention, you would light your cigarette, and then you would stand there at attention and smoke it. And then when the ash got long enough, you'd about face, walk over to the pail, and bend over and put the ash in there.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd stand up about face and go back out.
You had somebody watching you do this.
Oh, yeah. You know, if you tried to get two of them, two cigarettes, they'd nail you. But, some guys would just try to sneak two cigarettes out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was funny to watch that. I can imagine what it would have been like if I hadn't been a smoker just watching that.
Right.
But it was funny to watch it because you'd have to stand up at attention, about face, go back out to where you stood. And it was really up to the discretion of the drill instructor. Whether if you had a good day, if the platoon had a good day, then they'd let you smoke. If they didn't, you didn't smoke. So
right.
you, that was one of the motivating factors because back then, well, most of the people smoked.
Mm-hmm.
And cigarettes were cheap there anyway.
Okay.
So. But, the physical part, I could run for miles, so it really wasn't that hard.
Mm-hmm.
He's always scared that he's going to screw up.
Right. You wrote in your questionnaire about the buddy system. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the buddy system was, I think it was more of a motivation for to get more guys to join. Guy I grew up with, Rudy Carl, who ended up being one of my brother-in-laws. He ended up marrying my wife's sister. He and I grew up, and of course, it was one of those deals. We all knew he was going to go into service just a matter of when. In fact, he lived on a farm right down the road from me, so I've known the guy since I was about 5 years old. And so we kind of looked at each other and said, yeah, we're going to join the Marines. And so we joined together, yeah. And the buddy system was supposed to, you would join together, you would guarantee to go through boot camp together, and that was it. You were guaranteed to be in the same platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were. Now, really, it didn't make that much difference because he was on one end of the squad bay and I was on the other, and you never had free time to mingle.
Right.
So, if I would seem from a distance, like all the way down the other end of the building, and that was really about the only time we ever saw each other.
Mm-hmm.
We would see each other when we fell out, falling platoons, into a formation,
mm-hmm.
but you never got to speak to each other. But it was
right.
kind of comforting to know somebody was there that you knew.
Right.
But that was the buddy system. You were guaranteed to go through boot camp, and then when I got it, when boot camp was over, now he was an old 311, so he was a grunt. He
mm-hmm.
was an infantry straight out. And usually, if you got old 311, if you were an infantry MOS within a month after boot camp, you were in Vietnam.
Right.
It was almost guaranteed. I was made a 2111, which is a weapons repair and armor. And so they sent me to school at Quantico to be basically a gunsmith, which I really enjoyed. And I was really mad. I really wanted to be infantry after, you know, if I'm going to be in the Marines, I'm going to do everything the way I always knew Marines were, and that was infantry. So
right.
when I got, I was really disappointed, and I couldn't believe it.
They chose you for this.
They chose me and one other kid out of the whole platoon. There was about 120 guys in this platoon, I guess. And there was only two of us that got chosen to be weapons repair and go to armor school.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe it. And I'd say about 80% of the guys were infantry because they just needed them so bad in
right.
Vietnam.
Right.
And it was a big buildup, so they sent him. And I'd say within 6 weeks after boot camp, he was sitting in Vietnam.
Wow.
And I was I went to Quantico for 2 months of schooling, really ended up enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, instead of going to Vietnam, which a lot of the guys did, they sent me back to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, put me in tanks, tank company.
Okay. Before we get there, are there any particular instances you remember from boot camp that, when you think back about it, that you think of?
You mean bad incidents?
No, just good, bad.
To me, the whole thing wasn't that bad. I enjoyed it. I really did. It was good for me. I was so proud when I got through with it. Some of the things the drill instructors did to some of the guys were bad. If they didn't like you, or if you screwed up, then they would really take it. Sometimes they would take it out on the whole platoon, or they would take it out on individually. I know this one, once again, it was this Jewish kid. Some reason or other, they didn't like him, and they just stuck his head. They made him stand by a door, and we were all standing at attention. And I just, where my barracks, my bunk was, I could see what they were doing to the guy out of the corner of my eye. And they just, he stood there with his head against the door, back of his head against the door, and they took a rifle butt and just slammed it against the door right beside his head.
Wow.
Just relentlessly on, just, you know, and calling him a worthless piece of crap and all kinds of stuff, and you're a piece of garbage, you're not good enough to do anything, you know, low life, and just kept calling him that, Pretty soon the kid did crack up, and they ended up taking him out of there in a straitjacket.
Wow.
And what the kid did, I have no idea. I don't know what he did to make him mad. I think it was just because he was a Jewish kid.
Okay.
And that's just thing that they always stuck in my mind, the way they treated the Jewish kids.
Were any of your drill instructors, had they had any experience in Vietnam?
All three of them. We had one senior and two juniors, and all three of them were Vietnam vets.
Did they talk about their experiences with you?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things we took it to heart, because these guys knew what they were talking about.
Right.
And Staff Sergeant Hatfield was my senior drill instructor.
Mm-hmm.
Sergeant Caldwell and Sergeant, I'll think of his name in a second, Caldwell and Bennett, right. Bennett was a big black guy, and Hatfield and Caldwell, Caldwell was a black guy. Bennett and Hatfield were the two white guys. And the one, of course, it was just like you see in the movies, one's a good guy, one's a bad guy.
Right.
The senior was there, but the two juniors, one of them played off on the other. And, you know, the black guy was a good guy, and the white guy was insane. And they would just scream, hoop, and holler, and then the other would take off on each other. I saw my senior drill instructor in Vietnam.
Did you really?
Yeah, I saw him later on. He was in tanks. I had no idea what his MOS was.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in tanks, and I would just happen to be on a convoy. And sure enough, I looked at him, and I thought, that's my drill instructor. So I went over and talked to him. And he invited me down in his bunker, in his tank, and he had a case of beer in his tank.
Uh-huh.
And so we sat there and shot the bull, and I drank a couple beers with him. Right in the middle of nowhere, just some little outpost in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
But, yeah, that was kind of interesting to do that. But, yeah, he would get drunk, God love him, he would get drunk on his off time, and especially when we were on, when we were at the rifle range.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come in to the barracks drunk, and he would just go down. We'd all stand at our attention in front of our bunks, and he would go down the line and just randomly pick someone, and then he would just, they would take him in a back room, and then they would just whip on him.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you ever get chosen?
No, but he went, you know, you just stand there, and luckily he'd go by me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. And then if you didn't do too well on the rifle range, if you didn't qualify during practicing, if you didn't qualify, if you were having a bad day, they would give you extra training.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they would do is if you were like jerking the trigger, and mm-hmm. so you'd be off on the shoot, they would take your trigger finger and put it in the M14 and pull the bolt back and let it slam down your finger.
Gosh.
Which they did that to me because I was shooting low scores.
Uh-huh.
And it would make your finger more sensitive.
Okay.
For whatever reason they do it, and it would make more sensitive, so you wouldn't pull, instead of jerking on the trigger, you would slowly pull back on it because it hurts so bad you couldn't jerk on it. And it, believe it or not, it worked. And my score went up quite a bit. And then they would also take they did this to the guy I grew up with, or joined with, my future brother-in-law. They took him. He was a good shot. When I was a kid, he grew up with guns. But there's the Marine Corps way, and then there's your way. And of course, they wanted to treat you the Marine Corps way. And I don't think he qualified one day. They took him in one of the back rooms, and they took a wet broom and had him bend over, and they just pounded his rear end, just beat it, you know, mercilessly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was your motivation, less so. Yeah, they would do that kind of stuff.
That kind of stuff worked for you guys?
Yeah. It was really motivate you, that's for sure.
Have you seen the movie Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah, if you look at Full Metal Jacket,
uh-huh.
the boot camp part, uh-huh. first two-thirds of it, I guess, is boot camp.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
Okay.
That's the best thing on boot camp as far as the movie goes that I've ever seen.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that comparison.
Yeah, it's a lot like that.
Okay. Tell me about Quantico after you finished boot camp.
Quantico was nice. The only problem was it was an officer's, it was where the OCS was.
Mm-hmm.
And so, God, there's so many officers up there. You know, you're used saluting right and left. You didn't know who to salute and who not to salute, so you just covered your butt. You saluted everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we had just gotten out of boot camp stuff, so we were, you know, we saluted everybody. But it was really pretty. It was just, I think it's 30 miles south of D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Quantico Town was a nice little town, and you could catch a train went through there.
Mm-hmm.
And for like $3, you could get a round-trip ticket into D.C. So we, you know, on weekends, we'd hop over to the bus or the train station and $3 round trip, and we'd go into D.C. And so we went to D.C. a lot. It was really pretty, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, tell me about the training you had there.
The training was go to school, go to armory school. They taught me how to work on and disassemble and assemble and troubleshoot all the pistols, 45 pistols, the M14 rifles, Thompson submachine guns, anything the infantry used. It was strictly infantry school. So
okay.
Anything from light mortars, 106 or Colas rifles, machine guns, 30 calibers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still using the 30 caliber then. It was kind of a transition period from the 30 to the M60. And so anything the Marine Corps used. And so it was a lot of fun. We still worked with bazookas,
mm-hmm.
M1 rifles, anything they had. It was a lot. I really enjoyed it.
What was your favorite weapon?
I had to say the M14.
Okay.
I loved a 45 caliber pistol. I wasn't the greatest shot with one because we grew up with shotguns and rifles,
mm-hmm.
so not too many kids had a pistol. But I liked the 45. But the M14 is my favorite.
Okay. So you were there for 2 months.
I was there for 2 months.
And you went down Camp Lejeune.
Camp Lejeune. Spent almost a year and a half there. I didn't think I was ever going to go to Vietnam.
Really? You were still shooting to go to Vietnam, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was there, let's see, I guess I was there for almost 13, 14 months probably before I went to Vietnam. And it was just kind of amazing. Everybody was getting orders except me. And I kept asking why. And they said, well, you got a critical MOS. There just weren't that many guys with my MOS, and there was only like two of us in the whole battalion, mm-hmm. and the battalion is made up of four companies, and there were only two of us that were actually armorers mm-hmm. in the whole company. The rest of them were just guys that knew how to work on them, and it was just kind of, you know, after a while, I was volunteering. Of course, I had a platoon sergeant, Sergeant Bill Hanna. I probably shouldn't say his name, but he was my platoon sergeant mm-hmm. at Camp Lejeune, and I made rank pretty quick until Sergeant Hanna got there, and he had just come back from Vietnam, and we were standing in formation one day, and he said, okay, everybody that hadn't been to Vietnam, take one step forward. Mm-hmm. And there was like four or five of us in the whole company that hadn't been to Vietnam. Perhaps everybody had been to Vietnam by that time. Mm-hmm. And we took a step forward, and he looks at us and said, you guys will never make rank as long as I'm your platoon sergeant. And he, true to his word, I never made rank. And I was spent 16 months in grade as an E3, mm-hmm. and you only needed 4 months
right.
before you could get promoted. And I had a good, clean record, but none of us got promoted.
Why did that happen?
Why?
Yes, sir.
He just never put you in for promotion. Because if you hadn't been a Vietnam vet, you were a piece of crap to him. That's just the way he figured it. Hmm. And I said, well, you know, send me to Vietnam.
Right.
Simple solution to that.
Now, had you put in a request to go?
Oh, I put in a request. I volunteer weekly.
Really?
Practically daily. I volunteer for anything I can get my hands on. I volunteer for dog handler, mm-hmm. Prison guard at Port Miss, New Hampshire prison, escort bodies back. They always had a Marine. When the Marines' bodies came back from Vietnam, they were always escorted. You would have landed in California, so you always had a Marine escort to where the body went. And I volunteered for anything and everything.
Why didn't you get anything?
I never could figure out why. They said my MOS was critical for the tanks, because there were so few of us. And finally, I got orders. Thank God. And I'd hate to say I wanted to go, but by that time, I didn't join the Marine Corps to sit down, you know, sit back in the States. Mm-hmm. And everybody around me had been to Vietnam, and so I wanted, and that's one of the reasons why I joined, mm-hmm. just to go see, to be actually in a war, to see what it was like. Everybody, I hated to have a war and me not be in it.
Right. What were they saying about Vietnam? What did you know about it by then?
Most of the guys come back, and most of them didn't talk that much about it. It was bad. A lot of tanks. Tanks wasn't the best thing to be in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And a lot of tanks, because the bad thing about a tank, one mine could, you know, there's four crewmen to a tank, and so usually four guys got it all at once.
Right.
And RPGs and tanks draw artillery and, you know, like a magnet, it's just mm-hmm. not real good. But I love tanks. I thought tanks, by the time I got out of there, I almost had an MOS as a tank crewman. Mm-hmm. Only I had 5 months, you needed 6 months OJT in another job, and then they would qualify to have that MOS. I had 5 months, and then I got orders. So I would have been a crewman if I just lasted another month. I had a good time with it, but I just couldn't get out of I couldn't get out of Camp Lejeune.
Tell me what you did at Camp Lejeune.
I worked on all the weapons for the tanks. Now, I didn't work on the tanks themselves because they were 90 millimeter, but I worked on the machine guns. Mm-hmm. We had a 50 caliber machine gun, a tank had a 50 and a 30 caliber, and then the crewman usually had 45 caliber mm-hmm. revolver or pistols, not revolvers. But they had the semi-autos, and then we had everybody had to qualify with the M14, so I worked on all those, had submachine guns, because all the tanks carried submachine guns, mm-hmm. and so we would, I'd work on those and get them all prepared and stuff like that. It was a lot of fun. I got to the point, I really enjoyed it, and I would always disassemble and assemble, and I got to the point where we'd always, I could take five different weapons and take them all apart, and put them in a pile and mix them up, and they blindfold me, and I could put it, I could assemble, a 30 caliber, a 50 caliber machine gun, the M14, the 45 pistol and the Thompson submachine gun. Not Thompson, but the grease gun.
That's amazing.
And I could do it blindfolded, you know, but just by feel. But it was just fun. I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd take them out and test fire them, and that was always fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, I enjoyed the weapons. I really did.
So you were there for how long? 14 months or so?
Oh, about 14, 15 months.
Okay, and you finally got your orders to go.
Finally got orders.
When did you get your orders?
It would have been in October of 67.
Okay.
And when I got them, it was for the air wing.
Uh-huh.
I thought, boy, this is great. Because basically I would have just been, I would have worked on all the weapons that the helicopters use, which would have been the same, pretty much the same thing, the machine guns and the sidearms.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been M16s and the 45s and the machine guns, and just kept those up. So that would have been, one of my goals was to be a machine gunner on a helicopter, and so
okay.
I figured I could work my way into this. Plus, for my mother's sake, that was really good orders, you know, because it would have been like being in the States, but getting paid more. So it wouldn't have been a real dangerous job. And so for her sake.
So you were sending money home to her?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for her sake, I was glad. I wanted to go over there so I could make more money, because I was taking home $98 every 2 weeks, so
uh-huh.
he's only making $24 or $24, I think it was $24. That was clear in a week in the States, and so that wasn't much. Yeah. And so, but everything was cheap, so cigarettes were only like dime or 15 cents back, and beer was real pretty cheap, so it really wasn't that bad. But usually by the second week, you were running out.
Right.
And I was sending money home, too.
Right.
So, but... Well,
tell me about going to Vietnam. How'd you get over there?
Went over there in, went to Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
And spent like 3 weeks there training, jungle training, their training. And then we left El Toro Air Base, Air Station, Marine Corps, at midnight, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and flew to Hawaii. Spent about an hour or two there getting refueled and flew to Okinawa.
Were you on civilian air?
Yeah, we were. We flew over civilian. A lot of guys went over ship, but we went over civilian. It was like Continental Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
It had the stewardesses and the whole everything just like that. It was strictly all Marines. On this one, it was all Marines. And so we flew to Okinawa, spent 5 days in Okinawa, and then finally went to Vietnam.
Okay. What was the flight over like? What were the men like on board?
Oh, it was very boring. Very quiet. Well, it started out kind of rowdy, naturally.
Right.
But it was like a 16-hour flight. Mm-hmm. So it was just unbelievably boring. So a lot of guys, if you didn't read, which I did, so it wasn't so bad for me. I always carried a couple books.
Mm-hmm.
So I could read. And, of course, you didn't know hardly anybody, because as one of the bad things about Vietnam, you didn't, unless you were one of the first outfits over there, you went over as a replacement. And so when you went into you reported in, you didn't know anybody. Very seldom did you ever know anybody, so you had to, you know, prove yourself before they would accept you.
Right. What did you think of that policy of the 12-month rotation?
Well, it's probably good, but it was good and it was bad. You knew, at least you knew you could see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
That's one good thing, because you had a date you worked towards, and you knew when that date came up you were going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as replacements go, no, it wasn't good, because just rotation. And they put you know, if enough guys got wounded and got medevaced or killed, then you replaced them. And so it was a constant rotation like that.
Mm-hmm.
And some outfits naturally had more than others, just depending on how much combat and stuff they saw. But, you know, that's the way we knew it. That's the only way we knew about it, so we didn't have any feelings towards it.
How much did it damage unit cohesiveness?
I don't think it damaged them that much.
Okay.
I really don't.
Okay.
Usually if you had good NCOs, they would take care of you. I thought it was kind of stupid, because if you went on patrols and stuff, a lot of times they would put the new guy as a point. Well, this poor guy didn't know his left from home ground about anything. And they always said if you were in the infantry that if you lasted the first 3 months, then you probably had a good chance of making it home. And so they put these poor guys out there, and you know, they didn't know that much about the booby traps and stuff, which they tried to teach you that at Camp Pendleton. They did teach you a lot. They tried to show you all that stuff. But training and the real things are two different things.
Right.
You know, getting caught in an ambush or something, because a point usually is almost like a suicide position.
Right. Did you ever have to walk point?
Unfortunately, a couple of times, yeah. I never did feel comfortable with it. I didn't go on that many patrols, thank God. Went on several, but not as – I wasn't infantry, but just happened to be – that's one of the things about the Marine Corps. I'll have to give them credit. They, if you're a cook, office pogue, or anybody, they train you first as an infantryman.
Mm-hmm.
They do give you good training. So no matter what your job is, you're going to be trained as a rifleman first, and your other MOS is secondary. So you do have two MOSs. You're always an 0311. But then you'll have your other job.
Right.
And so that way they always make sure that you know how to do the weapon. Now, we didn't get as extensive infantry training as an infantryman would.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was good training. And then I landed in, I landed in Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when you first open the door, it's just the breath when you first walk out, it just takes your breath away because of the heat and the humidity. And see, I would have gotten there in November, just before Thanksgiving, so it would have been around the 15th or 20th of November.
Right.
And you, of course, the smells and everything is all different, so you got to get acclimated to that. And you go into the hangar, and they tell you what your orders are. Of course, I had my orders, whereas First Marine Air Wing,
mm-hmm.
which is down at Chulai,
mm-hmm.
and by that time they'd moved up to Da Nang, I think. So the Marine Corps, in their infinite way, they have a way of they don't worry about what you come over there with. It's what they need you now. So they changed me as soon as I got there. They said you're heading north. These orders are no good.
Okay.
You're out of your mind, but I wasn't going to argue with them a little, but
mm-hmm.
wasn't much good. I knew that wasn't much good. So they sent me up to. They put me in 3rd anti-tank. I had no idea what they were talking about.
Right.
And because I'd just gotten out of tanks.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, shoot, something got to do with tanks. So they sent me up to a Fubai, which is about north of there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's 30, 40, 50 miles north.
Mm-hmm.
And I flew up there and got off and caught a jumped in the back of a truck, and they took me out to the Antos place, and they were stationed with the tank, so it was an Antos outfit.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know anything about Antos.
Why don't you describe it for those who are listening who might not know what that is?
Yeah, an Antos is a tracked vehicle, weighs about 9 tons, and a tank usually, I think a tank weighed about 52 tons, I believe it was. So this was just a tracked vehicle, had a Chrysler engine in it,
mm-hmm.
small, had 6 106 recoilless rifles on it.
Okay.
Had a 3-man crew. It had a big Chrysler engine in it, so it ran on gasoline, whereas the tanks ran on diesel. These things could really move, and you could fire them one at a time, two. Usually it's three on each side, like in a triangle. One, two, and then three. And they had a 50 caliber spotting rifle on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was they weren't the best vehicles in the world. The Army, the reason Marine Corps had them, because the Army didn't want them.
Okay.
Yeah, if you were to scrape through the Marine green, you'd come down to the Army green, and there had been a big white star on it. So that's why the Marine Corps had it, because the Army didn't want it. And that was a lot of, back then, that was a lot of, we got a lot of equipment. The Marine Corps got a lot of equipment that the Army didn't want. If the Army didn't want it, then the Marine Corps got it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it was back then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they had the better weapons. They had the newer equipment. We had stuff from the Korean War, if we were lucky. It's just kind of funny, in a way. You know, got to be kind of a, you resented the Army a lot because they seemed to have so much more equipment.
Right.
But anyway, that's another story.
Well, tell me about, this was an Antos unit. Now,
right.
what was your specific detail on that?
I worked on the weapons. Now, I was qualified to work on a 106. I had no idea what to do with one, but I was qualified. I was supposed to be one of the weapons I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in school, armor school, that I did take one apart and put one back together, and that was it. And
okay.
for a year and a half, I never saw one again. So they stuck me in there. And so I was low man on the point. I think there were seven Ontos, or seven armors in that outfit. And I think a week after I got there, about a week after I got there, they disbanded the whole outfit. Except for one company that was up at Quezon. And they left them up there because they were good. They had a lot of firepower, plus the NVA had blown all the bridges,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't get them out.
Okay.
So they were stuck up there. So being a low man on the pole, I think it was about 3 weeks after I got to Fubai,
mm-hmm.
I got orders for Quezon.
Okay.
And there was two of us, a supply sergeant, or he was a corporal at the time, a supply corporal, and myself, we got orders for Quezon. Of course, we were trying to figure where this place was. And at
mm-hmm.
the time, it wasn't a bad place.
Mm-hmm.
It had some really bad fights, some just a really bad battle up there, really a big battle in
mm-hmm.
April and May of 67.
Right.
They called those the hill fights. And, several hundred Marines got killed in that one. And that was when they first came out with the M16,
mm-hmm.
especially for the Marines. And I don't know when the Army got theirs. I think they got theirs sooner than we did. But we were at that transition from the M14 to the M16. And the M16s that we had, that they gave those poor Marines. It was the first big battle with the Marines with the M16. And a lot of them were defective.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of them, and this was, they were basically fighting in elephant grass, so there was a lot of chaos in there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Marines died because their rifles jammed.
Right.
And they were finding, they were finding bodies with guys with their cleaning rods stuck down in the barrel trying to get to unjam it.
Mm.
And these guys are getting killed while they were trying to unjam their weapons. So it was a pretty bad, but they end up, the Marines end up winning that one, but still. At a higher price than they needed to. If they had
right.
just kept the M14, it wouldn't have been nearly as bad.
M14
was a much better weapon.
Now, tell me, when you arrived at Quezon, what were your first impressions?
When I first got there, the other guy's name was Daryl Lane. Daryl and I took 3 days to get up there because of the fog.
Hmm.
And finally, we finally got out of the airport at Fubai, flew there, and when we got off the plane, it flew in a C-130,
mm-hmm.
and we got out, and he just stand there and look around. But there was only a few hundred Marines up there then. It wasn't the big one that it ended up being. It wasn't nearly as populous then.
Right.
It was just like a little outpost. Basically, it was a jumping-off point for the for one battalion of Marines to. They came in there, and they from Quezon, they would get in the helicopters and go out into the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And engage the enemy, and then they would come back. And there was hospitals and stuff right there. So it was kind of like the rear area for up there. But it was beautiful country. God, it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It was a plateau, but when you first got off the plane, you looked around, you looked at the mountains, and that was all pretty. And then you looked at where this thing is. Everybody's living in tents,
mm-hmm.
and it's just mud, and it's just dirt. And it wasn't monsoon then, so dust was flying everywhere, and you look around, and good God. But then again, I thought, well, this may not be too bad, because you're not in the rear, so, it won't be inspections or anything like that. So this could be okay.
Right.
So we finally found where the Ontos section was, and
mm-hmm.
so they put me in a tent, and then they started going to work.
Now, a tent by yourself, or with other
men? No, it was a big tent, probably about 8 or 10 guys in there.
Okay.
Eight or 10 Marines.
Were they all part of the Ontos unit?
Right. You were in your own little compound-like, and there was tanks behind us. We were kind of like there was a 105 recoilless rifle, not 105 recoilless rifle, 105 artillery, the 155 artillery, and the tanks, and us. We were all kind of clustered there together.
Okay.
And so it was kind of interesting that, because we got to watch the artillery work out, the tanks work out.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put us on the line when they, we pulled guard. This is one, back then there wasn't that many, it wasn't really considered bad duty because nothing had happened for several months.
What, guard duty?
pulled guard duty. It wasn't considered bad duty as far as the enemy went.
Right.
It was really kind of a skating place. It was kind of a neat place to be, because you just did your, basically 9-to-5 job, and they goofed off the rest of the time, or they would send you, you'd have to go out on listening post, and they'd put you out and go on small patrols out there, out the perimeter, maybe several hundred yards out.
This is the first time, though, that you went on point when you were
right,
these patrols?
Right, when I did this stuff.
Can you talk about that?
Oh, well.
What were they like?
It was pretty frightening. Now, the first time I went out, I didn't have to go on point, no.
Okay.
No, I didn't have to go on point the first couple of nights. They treated us guys, the infantry didn't, we would go in there with them. They did their own stuff. Now, after a while, once you finally got to the point where you felt somewhat comfortable going on patrol, then they'd put you on point.
Right.
It was kind of like a voluntary deal. They'd ask you if you wanted to do it, because you weren't really part of their outfit.
Mm-hmm.
You were just filling in. And so they would ask, I say, sure, I'll try it. And, it was pretty scary. And it really wasn't that bad because Quezon wasn't that, it's not like where there's a lot of Viet Cong. Viet Cong is the one that usually set the booby traps.
Mm-hmm.
We were up in the mountains and in the valleys and stuff, and so there's pretty, we go down the trails and stuff. You would watch out. You didn't come across that very few booby traps around in that area.
Mm-hmm.
It was later now, you would see signs of animals. It was interesting that way because at one time when they still had royalty and there wasn't war going on, the area around Quezon was considered prime hunting grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of animals up there.
What'd you see?
I never saw them, but I heard the tigers. Now, a lot of guys did see tigers up there. Elephants, you would see an elephant every once in a while, smaller Asian elephants, stuff like that. Monkeys all over the place. Supposedly there were panthers up there, but it was a prime hunting area for the royalty. And a lot of people, I think Hemingway at one time had gone over there and hunted big game in that area before the war and all that stuff, before there was a war. So it was a beautiful area, just absolutely beautiful. You could see Laos from where we were. Laos is only 6 miles away, and you could see the mountains of Laos. It was like being in Kentucky or Tennessee, if you've ever been in the Smoky Mountains. That's what it was like.
Now, what was the specific job of the Antos unit you had there?
I was weapons repairman. I worked on the 106, made sure the timing and everything was right, and the machine guns, and the rifles and the pistols, and just anything, the weapons, made sure everything was going on right. Now, the one thing that I didn't get real comfortable with, that the armor's there, the guys that were there before me were basically maintenance guys, and they worked on the Antos themselves, and I wasn't that familiar with them.
Right.
And that wasn't part of the job that we were trained, but these guys had been there with this outfit so long, they ended up pulling maintenance. Well, they wanted me to pull maintenance, and I didn't have the faintest idea what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you're talking about. Give me a weapon, I'll take care of it. But, no, I didn't. So I was kind of a disappointment in that way. But then I was really good with the weapons, so that wasn't too bad.
Right. Now, had you experienced combat at all at this point?
No, I had never been. I got shot at a couple times when I was at Fubai by a sniper, and I was so dumb I didn't even know they were shooting until somebody told me.
Really?
Yeah, I always stand there outside of our the wooden hooch that I lived in. There was a sniper. We stand there. Next to our hooch was a cemetery, and we're standing out there sitting on the wall of the cemetery smoking cigarettes, and all of a sudden these little puffs of dirt fly up around us. I don't know anything.
Right.
And these guys are hitting the deck, and I'm still sitting down there smoking. So they had to tell me that I was being shot at. But then after that, I got to learn it real quick after we got up Quezon. But
now tell me about the first time you experienced combat. Was it up at Quezon?
Yeah, that was probably it. The first time, one of the worst things I ever had to do up there was when I first got there. I wasn't there but just a few days, and they, like I said, it was a jumping off point for the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And so one morning, getting under helicopters. And, of course, where our area was, we could see the airstrip real well, very easily. Mm-hmm. It's like 100 yards away. So he's watching all these guys. And they went out, and I guess they got into one hellacious battle. And, of course, then within a couple hours, then here come the medevac choppers went out, and they started medevacing Marines in there. And I just happened to be in a Jeep going by the airstrip at the wrong time, because the helicopters landed, and there were so many wounded on there, the guys that worked, the corpsmen and everybody that worked at the aid station, there were so many of them, they were overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. So they were stopping all of us guys, and we had to run up there and start helping these guys, getting these guys off the helicopters. And some of these guys are really, you know, messed up bad, and I'm like, oh, welcome to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so that was my initiating. You know, I threw up on that one.
Did you really?
Yeah, some of these guys are really, you know, guts hanging out and stuff like that, and just chest ripped open and head wounds and stuff like that. And I'm going in there. The bottom of the helicopter is just covered with blood, so you went in there and you slid all over the place. And I'm looking around and, oh, God. So I went out, threw up, and went back in and did what I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I thought, well, it's going to be a long year. It's starting out like this. Uh-huh. This is going to be a long one.
Uh-huh.
And then, that was probably in December. It would have been December of 67.
Mm-hmm.
And then in January is when the siege began. So it really,
right,
up until that time, it wasn't that bad.
Tell me about the siege. Tell me how it began and what happened.
Well, Marine recon was, this is how you could tell that it was getting bad, because the Marine recon, when they would go out, we'd watch them get on the helicopters and they'd go out. And usually they went out for almost like 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And do recon on the area. Well, they were out there. You could see each time they went out, each day they would go out, they seemed to be making contact a lot sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have to send a helicopter out to extract them. And that's how you could tell, you know, something's not right. Of course, we're peons. We're not officers or anything, so we don't get the story.
Right.
You know, we're just going by what we can see and what we think's happening, anything that's passing down to us. And so you could tell it wasn't good, because it got to the point where reconnaissance would go out, and they would only be out there like an hour, and they would have to extract them.
Wow.
They were making contact that fast. So that meant there was a lot of NVA out there. We knew there was a lot of NVA,
mm-hmm,
and starting to build up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you never even wore flight. You never wore flak jackets. Half time, you didn't carry weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even wear helmets. It was just like really nice place.
Right.
But then we knew something bad was going to happen. Then one night, I believe it was January 2nd, January 2nd,
68. Mm-hmm.
That's when there was a Marine patrol out in front. I was on guard duty that night, and I was facing the mountains. I believe I was facing 881 or 861.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they were side by side, close together, so I was facing that direction. And there was was kind of on a rise, and then right in front of me, about 100 yards in front of me, was elephant grass. And there was a Marine patrol out there. And we knew something, and I was sitting there in my bunker, and there was a tanker next to me sitting on his tank. And so we were shooting a bull, smoke cigarettes, shooting a bull. The sun was starting to go down, and we was facing out towards the elephant grass. And they started popping flares,
mm-hmm,
and mortar flares. Well, they do that every once in a while just to, you know, stir things up, and it's starting to get dark. But they kept popping these flares. Well, they just kept popping them, and we knew something was wrong. So I got in a bunker, and this Marine patrol had come in contact with, I think it was five NVA, and what this NVA were doing was going around. They were taking reconnaissance. They were going around the base. They were making maps of
right.
all the bunkers and what weapons are in each bunker. Well, they ended up engaging them in a firefight, and they did it right in front of my bunker. And so I had no idea that the Marines, all I knew is all of a sudden here come a bunch of bullets flying in on my bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea if they were the enemy or the Marines or what.
Mm-hmm.
And the enemy was caught between the Marines and my bunker. So we opened up, not knowing what in the world was happening. But all we knew was a lot of rounds were coming out of the elephant grass at us. So we started shooting out there, and come to find out, we almost shot our own guys.
Right.
But anyway, they killed five of them. I don't know if there's more than that. I don't think hardly any of them got away. Well, two of them, at least two, were Chinese,
mm-hmm.
were red Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got all the documents off of them. And so that's one of the ways they found out there was going to be a big siege. And then somebody surrendered. An
mm-hmm.
NVA officer surrendered, and when they interrogated him, he told about the big buildup and everything, too.
What do you think the Chinese officers were doing there?
Oh, they were advisors.
Okay.
They were advisors to the NVA. Supposedly, they were Russian advisors, too. Now, I never saw any, but I've always heard that there was Russian advisors, but there was always a lot of times there would be Korean, North Korean, or Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that unusual to... if one of them got killed.
Okay.
Very seldom did you ever hear about it. But, yeah, at least two of the bodies were Chinese. And you could tell by the build of them, you know, they were
mm-hmm.
much larger than the Vietnamese. And
mm-hmm.
and when they threw them on the back of a pickup truck, not a pickup, but a 6x, and they drove them right by us the next morning. And so, you know, we're looking in there, and there, sure they were. There was five of them laying in there, and... two of them definitely did not look like Vietnamese. The
right.
Vietnamese are smaller, and these guys were pretty good-sized guys.
Right.
A lot bigger built. And so they knew, by that time, they started bringing in, well, when they found out something bad was going to happen, there's only like one battalion of Marines up there. And before it was over with, they brought in three battalions.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an enormous buildup. Like overnight, all of a sudden, the perimeter... the base doubled in size, you know, in length especially.
Right.
And it's just all overnight, but then just you can just see them helicopter after helicopter of Marines coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started digging in, because by that time we were still living above ground.
Right.
Most guys were. And so we had started digging bunkers, and we filled thousands and thousands of sandbags and dug trench lines. And if you took an aerial view of it, it looked something like a World War One.
Mm-hmm.
battlefield, because we had trench lines
right
all the way around the perimeter.
And this is before the mortar fire and
right before it came in, before the siege began, we were
okay.
getting prepared. Now there were still a lot of guys living above ground
mm-hmm.
In tents when the siege finally began, and that was a slaughter. When I think it was one morning, I guess it was towards the end of January, probably mm-hmm. around 30th, 31st, somewhere
mm-hmm.
around there.
This is the Tet Offensive.
Right.
Right.
This is when the quote-unquote shit hit the fan.
Right.
The Tet Offensive began. I was on manning a 50-caliber machine gun on the line
okay.
because I was one of the few people in the area that knew anything about a 50, because I worked on those in the tanks. They'd just gotten 50, and they tried to have like 7 or 8 50s. Maybe more than that, around the perimeter, because
mm-hmm.
it was a good weapon,
right.
outstanding weapon, loved it. And I was one of the few that really knew how to work a 50. And so me and two other Marines got stuck on a bunker. It was a good-sized bunker down on the line, on the outside perimeter, but the ones closest to the perimeter,
mm-hmm.
and a man in a 50. And there was a M79... to my right, and a rifle to my left. I guess about every 20, 25 yards, there was a bunker.
Right.
And it was always manned, so yeah. I guess it was like 5:30 in the morning, it was before sunlight. I don't remember that. And all these rounds started coming in from, it seemed like they were coming in from the north and the west, and you could just hear the incoming coming,
mm-hmm.
just come roaring in there. And that's when they blew the ammo dump, and and a lot of guys in the center of the caisson base. That was the headquarters, and they were a lot of guys were caught sleeping in tents and stuff. So a lot of guys died on that one. But you could hear them roaring over us. They weren't concerned with us on the line.
Right.
They were concerned with trying to get as much of the central part of the base as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just sat there and listened to them, you know, come whistling over us and watching all the explosions. And when they hit the ammo dump, that of course it was just before daylight. So when the ammo dump went up, it was just unbelievable. You could just see fireballs going everywhere.
Uh-huh. What were you thinking about this time? How were you feeling?
Oh, I was scared to death. Of course, we were always taught that before an infantry attack, they hit you with the artillery and the mortars.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were waiting for the infantry to just come rolling in there. So we were, you know, we're down there waiting with our guns and everything, or machine guns and rifles and everything.
Right.
Just waiting for them to come up.
How many Marines were with you in the bunker?
There was just three in my bunker.
Okay.
Myself, I was the gunner, then there was a loader, and then there was normally it would have been an ammo bearer, but he was like the rifleman.
Okay.
And of course, we had our M16s
mm-hmm.
with us, too. And so we were just waiting. Luckily, nothing happened on that one.
Okay.
So, we, you know, for several, and that lasted, for several hours. That lasted.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy in my outfit named Arthur Bates. God love him. He was from Effingham, Illinois, in that area anyway. I think he's from a little town right outside of Effingham. And there was Ontos throughout, you know, spread out along the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur was, he ran, when that happened, he was down at the ammo dump. And Arthur was, they dove in a bunker, and there was 10 guys in that bunker. Arthur was the only one who survived.
Really?
Right. He took the ammo dump just kind of exploded and kind of caved in on it, and a round come barreling, I guess just ripped into it and just swirled around in there, you know. And Arthur was trapped like 6 hours in that thing.
Mm.
And he was the only survivor of it.
And you knew him. You were
yeah.
this.
Yeah, he was a nice kid from Effingham, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, poor Arthur, he was just like a basket case. They should have shipped him out, but they didn't. And, you know, somebody belched real loud. The poor guy was just going hysterical. It was really sad to watch him
mm-hmm.
because they should have sent him to Okinawa or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Let him get treatment anyway, but they didn't. So anytime you're around Arthur, you know, the poor guy ended up, you know, he'd giggle. It wasn't nothing was his fault. He was a normal guy before that, but after that he was just like a basket case.
Right.
And then later on when I was down in the ammo dump and it went up, it got blown up, poor Arthur was down there with me then. First thing I thought of after I got out, I thought, God, poor guy. Hope he made it. And he did make it. We always felt bad for Arthur,
mm-hmm.
but you could tell guys were dying just right and left. It was just...
How did you deal with that?
Really, you got to the point where you hate to say you got used to it,
mm-hmm.
but you did. And you really got an attitude to the point where you said, better him than me.
Right.
And that was the attitude you got, because I had some really good friends get killed over there, especially up there. And you know, you felt bad, but that was just part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so much, especially up there, it's just so much death. And you were sitting there, and it's been different if you were shooting at each other
mm-hmm.
with a rifle or something. We were just sitting there just getting the crap blown out of us.
You're just waiting, basically, and getting hit and getting
yeah.
hit.
Yeah, and they were smart. The NVA was smart. They would. Our heavy weapons couldn't shoot as far as their heavy weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So they would get just out of range of our weapons, and they could shoot at us, and we could shoot at them, but we couldn't reach them.
Right.
And they would just knock the crap out of us. Before the siege, before they knocked out the bridges, the Army had 175mm artillery, and they were bringing those up from Camp Carroll, and they were going to have them at Quezon, and that would have been great because they could reach anything that the NVA had.
Mm-hmm.
But they blew the bridge, and so they couldn't bring these the big guns up. So they had the supporters from Camp Curl, which is, I forget how many miles, several miles, like 12 miles away. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about Vietnam. You could be 5 miles away from someplace, and it's like being in another world. It's just, you just don't hop in a vehicle and drive there. It's,
right.
You're isolated. And we were isolated because you couldn't get in. It took more nerve to try to leave the place than it did to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And they had us, I think there was like 30,000 of them. Before it was over, there were 6,000 of us and like 30,000 of them.
You were there for 6 months, is that right?
Yeah. I was there from December until July, almost six and a half, yeah.
Tell me what your general impressions were of the NBA and the VC.
NBA was good. The NBA were good fighters. Can't complain about them. They were pretty dedicated. For the most part, the NBA came down from the north.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't. So they were pretty well motivated. They didn't come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail or across the DMZ,
mm-hmm.
and they were good soldiers. They fought, for the most part, they fought like soldiers should, seemed like. Viet Cong, on the other hand, you know, they were a little sneakier. They were guerrillas.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the NBA were pretty good. You had to admire their bravery for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it took a lot of nerve to become a sapper or anything like that. Of course, a lot of them were doped up. So they kept some of those guys pretty well doped up on those suicide things. Because we'd go out there every once in a while. Once, after, say, they hit the wall or something, you'd go out there and get the bodies. Sometimes you'd find dope on them.
Right.
And
Viet Cong or the NBA?
Yeah. It was. I don't know if it was. You didn't. Not all of them, I'm sure, did it. But,
okay.
But that was just, you would get dope off of them sometimes.
Was this either the Viet Cong or the
NBA?
NBA would, okay.
Yeah, that's the ones. Now, I should say, most of the people I dealt with were NBA. Later on, when I got out of Quezon, we'd come around Viet Cong. But
mm-hmm.
up at the siege, it was strictly, I'd say, frankly, nothing but NBA.
How did the other Marines feel about the NBA? Was it basically what you said? Was that kind of the general attitude?
Yeah, well, you know, we didn't like them, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you looked down upon them. That was one of the ways you could cope with it. You'd consider them, now this is my thinking anyway, you looked at them as subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you shot one or something, it didn't bother you that much. Of course, you got to remember they were trying to kill you, so it was either you or them.
Right.
And, of course, I was raised in the church and everything, and somebody always asked me how I would deal with that, and I really never thought that much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I always looked at it, well, that's why I'm in this outfit. If I didn't want to be to do this, I should have joined the Navy or the Air Force.
Right.
And but I joined the Marine Corps, so I'm going to act like a Marine's supposed to. And so I never really had that much feelings about it, and it still doesn't bother me that much as far as that goes,
mm-hmm.
because it's either them or me.
Right.
You know.
They'd
have shot me, I'm sure, if they'd had a chance. So.
Right. Did your religious beliefs change or evolve at all because of your experience in Vietnam?
I can't say that. My father was always very religious, my mother. We always went to church. And so when my father died, my mother stopped going to church. I don't know why. Well, I know why, because of my father.
Mm-hmm.
But I had my aunts and uncles around here, and they always made sure. And that's really kept me going.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to Vietnam, if I hadn't have been, my religion really kept me going in Vietnam.
Did it really?
Yeah, you know, it was a big help for me. It was a big help. Now, I was never a fanatic, but it was I was always aware. I always carried a Bible with me.
Mm-hmm.
You get pretty bitter, you get pretty hardened to a point, my religion helped me a lot. And when I got home, my experiences when I got home weren't the greatest, so I got bitter about that, I come from a small community, so no one gave me a hard time or anything.
Right.
And it's still a pretty patriotic little community.
Uh-huh.
And so many of us guys are in the service, and wasn't that bad.
How specifically did your religion help you when you were over there?
I prayed a lot, and it gave me a lot of peace of mind. And but after a while, even with religion, it when you see guys getting blown apart, it just affects you no matter what. You hate to ask why is it happening. Of course, you know why it's happening. It's a war. Mm-hmm. So, you wonder why certain guys get it instead of you.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, it's just pure luck. I know what it is. It's just pure luck. I don't think God had a higher calling for me than he did some other poor guy.
Mm-hmm.
As being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you get pretty fatalistic after a while.
Right.
And it's always interesting to watch people. I know when the artillery guys were working out, thing about the artillery, they would have to, they tried to knock out, the NVA would try to knock out the big guns
mm-hmm.
first. Of course, and so they would not try to knock out the artillery. And so these guys would have to stand out there, crap's coming in on top of them, they're out there just firing away. And so we were always amazed at them. I remember one time I went across, it was just a little road that separated us, and I went over there to visit with some guys.
Mm-hmm.
And some rounds come charging, and we just shooting the bull, sitting outside having a cigarette. And here comes some incoming. So we dove in this bunker, and I'm looking around, we're sitting there on top of all this ammo. I'm thinking, well, this is the dumbest place to be.
Uh-huh.
So I was asking this guy, why did we come in here? I said, well, this way, if it hits, it'll be almost instant.
Huh.
There's not no worry about getting maimed or anything. You're going to go.
Right.
And so they just sit there, and we're sitting there on top of all these artillery rounds. And I'm thinking, this is the stupidest place to be on the incoming. But they got a real fatalistic attitude. And so I never went over there again.
Right. You didn't like that idea.
I stayed away from them.
Right.
If I'm going to get killed, I at least want parts of me to be able to go home.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of, you got to the point where you really got used to the death. As terrible as it sounds, you just got used to it because there was so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'd go out to take a whiz, mm-hmm. and you'd look down, there'd be leg laying there, and you're sitting there taking a leak, and there's part of the body part laying there.
An American?
Yeah, I'd be an American.
Mm-hmm.
Because some poor guy got blown apart, and parts of him flew everywhere. And you'd be looking down, and all of a sudden you look over in the bushes, and there's weeds, little grass there, and there'd be just part of it might be a leg or hand or something laying there. So you go tell the corpsman or something, and sometimes you'd pick it up yourself, and then you'd take it down to the corpsman, and you just kind of give it to him, turn around, leave, let them figure out what to do with it.
Hmm.
But
and you got used to that.
Sometimes you just leave it alone.
Right. You got used to that.
Yeah, as terrible as it sounds, I've always been amazed at how that you can get used to anything. You
mm-hmm.
really can. Your brain can. It's amazing. You can adapt. We got to the point where we were getting hit so much sometimes that we would. And it was almost like a schedule. And pretty soon you knew the schedule. Okay, it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's about time to get hit with several rounds. And they got to the point where they were pretty much on the schedule too.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't get hit at that certain time, you kind of wondered, well, what's the deal here? What's wrong here? Are they sick or something? You're starting to worry about them. As dumb
right.
as it sounded, you're starting to worry. Is something wrong with these guys?
Right.
Because they're not trying to kill us at that particular time of the day or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you just got to be strange, and you got to that point. Where that's the way your mind worked. And,
mm-hmm.
The artillery come. One day we got hit with, I think we got hit from 11 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. That was a bad day. That was really bad. 6 straight hours of getting whacked. And I think they hit us like 12 or 13 or 1,400 rounds that day.
What would you do? Just hunker down in the bunker?
Yeah. That's all you do. You just lay in there and just pray it didn't hit your bunker.
Right.
And sometimes they'd have these rounds that, the ones that were really the worst ones were the ones that didn't go off, because you'd hear them screaming in, and you'd just hear them screaming in, and then you'd hear them hit, whoop, and you're waiting for the explosion, and there's no explosion, and you're wondering, is it a delayed fuse, because they would do that every once in a while. They would throw in a delayed fuse where it'd go off, it would explode after impact, say several seconds,
mm-hmm.
a few seconds afterwards. Well, then that could get you, because then it would blow up underneath you or right beside you instead of on top of you. And you just, psychologically, that was just terrible. The ones that never went off, to me, were the worst ones. You'd hear them just come screaming in there. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, nothing. You'd hear them hit, but no explosion.
Right.
And to me, that was one of the most frightening things. And you could always tell when they were coming in. You'd hear them, if you heard them come roaring in on you, then you just you know, tensed up and waited to die, basically. You hoping it wasn't going to get you. If it did, hope it was a quick one.
Would you talk to the guys in your bunker? What would you say to them?
Oh, well, you got to the point where you didn't say much, but you would make wisecracks. If you had some guy in there that has a good sense of humor, it was pretty good. You start making just goofy, off the wall jokes.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there's two black guys, myself, Manny Babbitt and Bob Harrell,
mm-hmm.
and they were in my company. They weren't in my platoon. And one day I was heading one direction, they were heading the other. Both those guys were coming towards me, and it was that day we got hit with those trap for 6 hours. And by that time, you know, I said I, and they said I. So by that time, the rounds come in. So Manny and Bob, three of us dove in a bunker, and we spent 6 hours there. And it was one of the funniest 6 hours. It was kind of a mixture of most terrifying and funny 6 hours, because those two guys were really good sense of humor, and three of us are just cracking
mm-hmm.
jokes. You had to. It was either laugh or cry. So
mm-hmm.
We had a good time. It was a terrifying good time. And you sit there and just, you know, when a round come in, you just prayed it didn't hit you. That's all you could do, just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
It was strange times.
How did you know it was all clear? Was it with a siren sound? Or
somebody would... Well, you waited. They would hit you. They would hit you like three or four at a time, and then it would be a short interval, and then they would,
mm-hmm.
you know, hit you some more. And you just waited, and pretty soon, you know, like gophers or prairie dogs sticking their head out. You kind of stick your head out and kind of look around. And pretty soon, a little bit more, you see more people moving,
mm-hmm.
and pretty soon you would you just kind of venture out and. When you usually had from 3 to 5 seconds to find cover.
Okay.
You could hear them coming in, and you'd hear the boom, boom, boom coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You'd hear them shooting, and from that, as soon as you heard that, you knew you had from 3 to 5 seconds, and it was amazing how much ground you could cover in 3 to 5 seconds.
Right.
So you just kind of stand there by the bunker and, you know, wait, and then you kind of venture out a little bit further and wait. And pretty soon, you just kind of start and you ran wherever you went. They
mm-hmm.
call it the caisson shuffle. Very seldom did you walk anyplace.
Mm-hmm. You walked to stay near bunkers? Or?
Oh, you walked. You try to stay as close to a bunker or a trench or someplace as you could.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time there was this staff sergeant, and he was a jerk. I can't remember his name. He's from the South. He was South Carolina or North Carolina, someplace down there, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was absolute. Pardon if I hate to say it, asshole. He was just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And
what made him that way?
Yeah, his attitude. He wouldn't talk to anyone that wasn't an NCO or below.
Hmm.
He was just absolute idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time I was walking across our little compound, and I was walking by the we call it the lifers' hooch. It's where the staff NCOs and the officers. Their bunker, and so I was walking by there, and I heard a round coming in. I heard it go off, so I dove in the doorway,
mm-hmm.
and I was facing outward. I just flattened myself against the wall, and I knew it was going to come over me, so there wasn't much chance unless it hit the top of the bunker, and I knew I was going to be relatively safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I flattened myself out against the wall, and I was looking outward, and I saw a staff sergeant run over to a trench. And by that time, rounds had started to come in on the other parts of the base.
Mm-hmm.
And so I dove in the bunker, or in that, you know, I called it the lifers' bunker. And I flattened out and was looking outward. And the staff sergeant was running towards this trench, or this, I guess, big ditch they dug for the water buffalo where we kept the water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we called the big tank.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this gas laying down in there. It was, we called him a hippie. He was a kind of a, he was kind of a shipbird. He was like the company shipbird.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the staff sergeant ran over to the edge of the trench, getting ready to jump in there, and saw that guy in there. He wouldn't go in that, down in there because that guy was there.
Wow.
Because he didn't like him. And that's just that he didn't like the, you know, this guy was like a year, 2 year PFC, so he was pretty much of a shitbird.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we liked him and everything, but the staff sergeant had no use for him. So the staff sergeant hangs left and starts running towards the lifers bunker where I'm standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably about 100 feet in between us. And he gets about halfway across, and a round comes roaring in there and landed right in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
And you just see this, you know, the round went off and the smoke went up and the dust went up, and I thought, well, he's gone. So when the smoke cleared, he's laying there, and it caught him, caught a big chunk, caught him right there in that artery in his thigh.
Mm.
And he's laying there, and this guy is so disliked. Now, very seldom would this ever happen, but no one would run out to help him.
Mm-hmm.
He was so disliked that no one would go out there and help him.
Really?
Yeah. And every time his, you know, every time his heart beat,
yeah,
he looked like an oil well coming out of his leg. Just blood was shooting out, and he was hollering for help. It was the only time I ever seen where someone was hollering for help and no one would go help him.
Mm.
And so we're laying, you know, I'm flattened out against her. I'm not going out there. No one else is going out there.
Mm-hmm.
I hated to say I really disliked this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps everybody else did. And the corpsman, he come running around the corner, and he said, he told us later, we saw him, he come around there, and he could just see him hitting the brakes. He saw who it was, but then everybody else saw him, too, so he had to go on out there and get him. And he said later, if he'd known who it was, he'd have been a lot slower coming around that corner.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up, I did help put him on a stretcher, but yeah, he lost part of his manhood there.
Did he
and,
really?
Yeah, he lost that. He'll never have kids, that's for sure. He didn't have any before. He didn't have any after.
So he survived.
He survived, yeah. We kind of thought he was going to go. And could have been probably another minute or less, he would have gone. But the corpsman, like I said, the corpsman, when he come around that corner, he saw who it was. And by that time, everybody else saw him, too. So he was pretty well committed to himself. He couldn't turn around and run the other way.
Mm-hmm.
But,
why don't we take a break just for a second?
Sir? Okay.
This is Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. John Hargesheimer. Today is June 2nd, 2003. It is at approximately 3:04 p.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library Interview Room on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Hargesheimer is in Silversburg, Indiana. Sir, let's continue with our discussion about Quezon and things that went on there. I had a couple of specific questions I wanted to ask you. Were you ever... did you ever witness, or were you personally, your position ever attacked by the infantry, or was it just shelling?
It was mainly shelling, yeah. It was just shelling. Now, the base itself was attacked a few times, but it was mainly on the where the Arvin Rangers were.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if the NVA picked them, you know, on purpose or what,
mm-hmm.
but the Rangers did a great job, and you know, we sat there and watched them.
Oh yeah,
and yeah, it was interesting, and the Rangers just kicked their butt. And one time they seemed like it was real foggy.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, it was real foggy, and the NVA had come out of the like the elephant grass, and there was
mm-hmm.
a clearing there, and they were getting in line, and they were going to get in on line, and they were going to charge. I guess they were going to charge the perimeter there, and all of a sudden it was in the fog, so you could hear them, but you couldn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just like they got in line out in the open, and then all of a sudden the fog lifted, and there they were.
Wow.
And it was just a shooting match. It was just a, you know, they just got whacked. They just got slaughtered.
Mm.
The fog, you know, everybody knew they were there, but you just couldn't tell where.
Right.
But it was kind of interesting because we all just kind of stood up on our bunkers and watched. And it was slaughter.
Wow. What was your impression of the Arvin and the Arvin Rangers?
Well, the Arvin Rangers were good. The ones up Quezon, they were real good. And I guess the Arvin Marines were good. And there was some Arvins divisions, regular army divisions that were good, but for the most part they weren't that great, and it wasn't their fault. It was mainly because of the officers.
Mm-hmm.
The Arvin officers were not that great.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part.
Okay.
But and the ones that came up and relieved us, now that was a ragtag outfit. But,
oh yeah, what? How could you tell?
I don't know what division it was or mm-hmm. what, but they were very undisciplined. When they came up there with the 1st Air Cav, and I believe it was one of the Marine regiments, I think it was the 3rd or the 4th Marines, came up, and then the 1st Air Cav come in there, and then they stuck in a Arvin division or Arvin outfit, I forget what it was, but they were just, they were nuts. They were going around trying to steal everybody's gear, and we had to pull our weapons on them to get them away. You know, we didn't shoot them, but man, they were nuts. They'd come right in your bunker like we weren't there and try to start rifling through stuff. So I know quite a few of them got the hell beat up.
Mm-hmm.
But
how did that affect morale?
Oh,
I mean, did y'all give a damn or?
We never had much use for them anyway. But now the Rangers were different. They were good, but. These guys are just nuts, you know. They just come in there and they just start trying to steal everything they get their hands on. Everybody started beating on them. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say start beating on them, but you know they just got to be a nuisance. And I'm surprised some of them really didn't get shot.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for our officers, I'm sure the NCOs probably a lot of them would have gotten shot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
did you ever make any attacks out of your bunkers, out of your positions, or did you just basically stay there and endure?
Pretty much stayed on the base. Now, I know there was a, they were digging, it was Ken Pipes,
mm-hmm.
third, I think it was Bravo Company. Now, his company is the one that had they called them the Lost Platoon, I believe that's what they called them anyway. About 28 guys went out and got killed
mm-hmm.
right outside of base, and it was his boys that got killed, and
mm-hmm.
Ken Pipes is one of the, I've gotten to know him since I've gotten out, and he's probably one of the most better men I've ever met. He's just an outstanding human being,
mm-hmm.
and he took it really bad, I'm sure, and I know he took it really hard, because it was his guys out there getting slaughtered,
mm-hmm.
and I guess it was about a month later, he and his and some of these guys, they went out there to get the bodies, plus to get some revenge. And they went out there and pretty well kicked some ass for about 3 or 4 hours. They went at it.
Really?
And, yeah, it was Ken himself got a piece of shrapnel in his chest, I believe, and mm-hmm. he didn't go down. He kept going.
Hmm.
And he kept leading his men. And
what happened to that platoon out there?
Oh, it was Sergeant, what was his name? He had a French... The lieutenant had a French line, Lieutenant Jacques, J-A-C-Q-U-E-S,
uh-huh.
I believe is how you spell it.
Uh-huh.
And they went out, and they were just going to do some routine patrol outside, and they saw two or three NVA from a distance, and they started chasing them. Basically, they suckered them into an ambush.
Right.
And they went out there, and they were waiting for them, and they just got butchered. I guess it was about 100, not very far out, maybe a couple of hundred yards outside of the perimeter. And that was the last time anyone left the base for a month at least.
Mm-hmm.
And, they just went out there and got slaughtered. I 28 of them got killed, and I'm sure one got captured. And he was, he ended up going up to Ho Chi Minh Trail, and he didn't get to come home until they released all the prisoners.
Wow.
So he was up there for quite a while. And two or three of them made it back. You know.
So they could tell what happened.
Right. And you could hear it, you know, you could just hear it going off, but you couldn't see it because it was down like a low rise. And I know mortars and artillery were going at it trying to kill the enemy, but they didn't really know where they were firing, because I think the radio operator got whacked, one of the first ones, and so it was bad. But and then the poor guys had to lay out there for almost a month, and that really shook everybody up, because you knew they were out there.
Right.
You couldn't go get them because it was too dangerous.
Right.
So, but every once in a while they would probe the lines, and I got one time I was working a 50 caliber machine gun, and there's about 20 or 30 of them come out of the elephant grass. We knew they were there. We were just waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was a turkey shoot, basically. Hmm. They just didn't hit us hard enough with enough people. They would hit you, but it seemed like it was just, they didn't have their act together. I don't know what the deal was.
You think it was purposeful, the way they were doing it, or they just simply were more unorganized?
I don't know. I think the bombing really disorganized a lot of them. Mm-hmm. I think if it hadn't been for the air bombing, we'd have gotten, it would have been one hell of a battle. It could have really been bad. Mm-hmm. Worse than it was. Yeah, because the air just, it was almost like 24-hour around-the-clock bombing.
Right.
The B-52s and the Phantoms and the A-4s and all, just continuous. Plus, we were getting artillery support from the Camp Curl, the 175 Army, 175 millimeter, and they were just blasting all over the place. They were really the only ones that could reach, that could do any damage. They were some precision artillery work on that. And then our artillery was doing some numbers, too.
Could you guys call in your own artillery, or did you have to have someone else do that for you?
No, we didn't. Not with us. I'm sure they had FOs,
right.
Forward observers,
right.
And there was a lot of snipers. Now, there was a lot of snipers up in the grass and up in the hills, and they would zing rounds in every once in a while. Some poor guy would get shot.
Now, how did you deal with that psychologically? Was that something you thought about all the time?
Yeah, you always thought about it. You just never walked anywhere, and you always, like I said before, you always tried to get your bearings, and you always knew where the closest place was. And really, it was just, you just ran, you just didn't walk somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You just always ran and just hoped you made it.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, believe it or not, it's just a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrible way of life, but it's just a way of life. And,
right.
I saw one poor guy get his, I guess they were using 50 caliber. It was a heavy round, I know that. And it caught the kid right underneath the chin and just took his head off.
Oh, gosh.
And, of course, he took about two more steps before he dropped, you know. And you could hear the rounds coming through the compound, so everybody dove for cover. And this, he wasn't in mine. I believe he was in artillery because he went through ours into the artillery compound. And, the poor guy got his head, just took his head right off. And
did you actually witness that?
Yeah. It just kind of, his head just kind of exploded. I guess it caught him just above the neck, right around that area, and just took it off.
Now, forgive me, but you're talking like this is really routine. Is that how it became for you guys there under siege?
Yes, for some people. I guess I took it better than others. I really don't know why.
Right.
I know some guys would see it and, you know, they'd freak out. And poor old, I know a couple of guys that did. But to me, talking about it is really good.
Mm-hmm.
If you hold it in, it's worse. And for several years, I would never mention my wife even says that. And now she says it's good because, especially going to these reunions and stuff and being around other guys.
Yes, sir.
Other Marines, especially ones that went through all of men, Marines, and Army, and all the other guys that went through it. And, we start joking and goofing around. And and even all the wives even mention how much better we've been since we've been started doing this.
Hmm.
That's probably only been within the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a last 10 years, probably last, I've been able to really discuss it. And, it's pretty matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sound callous or anything.
No, you don't come across that way at all.
It's just part, to me, it's just history. And I love history. And I always love listening to the World War II guys and the Korean War guys talk. And it's just something that needs to be said.
Yes, sir.
So that's the way I look at it.
Okay. Were you able to talk about it with your fellow Marines there while it was happening? How much comfort could you give each other? Or was it something that you just simply did not talk about?
No, well, you got to be rather pretty callous about it. It hurt, especially if you were close to the guy. Now, if you saw somebody that get hit that you didn't know, you felt bad, but, the old saying, better him than me.
Right.
And that's the way you got. You got to be saying, thank God it wasn't me. And or somebody that you're really close, and you try not to get too close, but you know, after a while you couldn't help but get close to some of these guys, because we went through a lot together. Excuse me. And but yeah, you hated to see a American get killed,
yes,
no matter what branch of service he was. But he really hated, and some guys just did dumb things. You know, they'd wait till the last second to dive in a hole. They would like make it almost a game. I definitely didn't, but they would. It was like a dare. It was almost like a macho thing. Some guys would wait. You could hear it, and when you heard the rounds go off, you have from 3 to 5 seconds to find cover. And some guys would just kind of wait until the last second.
Mm-hmm.
You could hear that round screaming in. Now I didn't see it too often, thank goodness. But I've heard other guys talk about it, and you know, how crazy some of these guys got. And you did get pretty crazy. You got to do stupid things, but.
Mm-hmm.
And some people just took it worse than that. You either laughed or you cried, and I'd usually laugh. If you cried, you end up cracking up. So I decided this wasn't going to have no way am I going to let them get me. So you
like,
start making crack, you know, wisecracks and stuff like that.
Right. It sounds like the reactions were almost personality dependent. Depending on one's personality, that's how you kind of reacted to what was happening.
Yeah, and I always said because my father died when I was pretty young, and a lot of my relatives died, and I've been around death more than I guess some of the other guys, and I think the people that hadn't been around death, now none of ours were violent like this, but we'd seen dead bodies, and we were, I won't say used to it, but we weren't that we were exposed to it before,
right?
Before any of this happened. I always said maybe that's the reason why my father died.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Terrible. Well, I guess I had to have some justification for him dying young, but it seemed it worked for me, and so it I took it better than some, and I'm sure. So,
what did you think of the leadership there at Quezon?
I thought the leadership at Quezon was great. Yeah, I couldn't complain at all. Now there were some. You know, I've had an NCO that wasn't, or not NCO, a CO. I had three commanding officers while I was there, and one was outstanding, and the other two were okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't say too much bad about them. They weren't the greatest leaders in the world, but I wouldn't want to have been in their position.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to judge when you're not doing it, but then you look back on it, think of all the decisions they had to make. I don't know if I would have wanted that, that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to knock them. At the time, it was easy to knock them, you know, because and their decisions meant life or death.
Right.
And that's a tough thing to do.
What made that outstanding leader, that outstanding CO, that outstanding?
He understood the men better. He was a Mustanger. His name's Albert Owen, Al Owen. And Al, a Mustanger, is a guy that was enlisted before he became an officer. So he spent several years as an enlisted man. And so he understood the men better. He understood enlisted how they thought and how they, you know, should act and everything. And he, when he said something, it meant something to you. When he gave you an order, you knew he knew what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The other two, you kind of had your doubts about,
mm-hmm.
But you still did it. But you didn't particularly care for this. And they would pull some bonehead orders for if. Al Owen gave you an order, you knew it made sense.
Right.
And you had a lot more faith in him, a lot more respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
The others, you did it. And sometimes guys got killed, unfortunately.
Right. What about overall leadership in Vietnam? What was your opinion of that at the time and looking back?
From the commander, from the captains on down, I would say for the most part they're pretty good. The majors on up are the ones that weren't out in the field. The ones out in the field were pretty good. And, of course, you did have some screw-ups, but for the most part, they were good. The majors on up, I really never had that much dealings with them.
Mm-hmm.
They were back in the rear, and, you know, I guess they were okay, really. I couldn't say much about them.
Mm-hmm.
One way or the other, I never had that much dealings with them.
Okay. Did you guys question or talk about the overall American strategy in Vietnam and the leadership the United States was receiving there?
Maybe because we were so young and dumb, we never really talked that much about the strategy. It was basically just a thing of survival.
Yes, sir.
The overall picture, no, I didn't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Didn't have a clue. You know, I know much more about it afterwards than I did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you couldn't see the forest for the trees at the time.
Right.
And then you can stand back. I love to read, and military history is my favorite. And so I've read probably hundreds of books on Vietnam, mm-hmm. when the French were there, and followed Dinh Binh Phu, and when all the French were fighting in there. And so I read all that just mm-hmm. to see what in the world, why we were there and what happened. And so I know much more about Vietnam now than I ever did.
What books stand out in your mind about, if you can, you don't have to remember titles, but if you do, that's great. What, you've done all this reading. What's your opinion?
My opinion of the books or of the war?
First of all, of the books and what's been written, and if any stand out to you.
Bernard Fall, now he wrote Hell in a Very Small Place.
Yes, sir.
And let's see, what's his other one? Oh, Street Without Joy.
Yes, sir.
Street Without Joy. Now, they were really good. And, of course, we were always compared to Dinh Binh Phu. Kaesong was always being compared to Dinh Binh Phu, so it's Hell in a Very Small Place was really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read those a couple of times. And I'd say, as far as when we were there, 13th Valley by John DelVecchio, it's about, I think it's 101st, when they went into the Alshaw Valley. Now, that's a really good book.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, the guy knew what he was talking about. And you can always tell if a person, you know, some books you pick up and read and throw them away. Now, it's hard for me to throw a book away,
mm-hmm.
and some of them are just trash. Let's see, there's some really good ones about Kaesong. Ray Stubbe wrote one. I can't think of the name of it right now. But he's written, I don't know if you know anything about Ray Stubbe. He was a chaplain at Kaesong.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that actually got this Kaesong Association going.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives up in Wakarusa, Wisconsin. And he's almost saintly to us, to most of us. He's an outstanding man.
Mm-hmm.
But if you hold on a second.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. I just want to see it. Kaesong. Let's see. I'm looking at the books right now. I got mm-hmm. a ton of them right here. In fact, when people see them, they can't believe how many I've got. Kaesong Siege in the Clouds by Eric Hamill is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at Ray Stubbe's, and his is Valley of Decision. I knew it was, couldn't think of the title, but it's Valley of Decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray is he's a historian, and that's really well written. There's some good ones. I've read them. When they would come out, I would pretty much read them.
Mm-hmm. It's helped you understand why you were there and what was happening to you.
Yeah, to me, it's just, and my daughter just can't understand why I read all this stuff. She says, don't you want to forget this stuff? And I said, no, I don't want to forget any of it.
Right.
And to me, it's part of history. And I just, and Vietnam is probably one of the most complex wars we've had, because there's so many things that went on in so many different places that you never knew about.
Yes, sir.
You know, a mile, something could happen a mile away and you wouldn't even know about it till you read about it years later.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was just so many different things going on. It wasn't one big line of fire going on, you know, infantry or battles. It was just small battles everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's just interesting. There's just so much, you know, like going into Laos and Cambodia, we never knew all that stuff. Had no idea about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so interesting what the Army did down south. Had no idea until I got out and read about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, to me, it's a fascinating place.
Tell me about base life at Kaesong. You know, when just with the men, what you would do for entertainment, just hanging out. What kind of things would you guys do?
Really wouldn't. Wasn't a whole lot to do. It was pretty boring.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a boring life, because you would do your job. Like I would work on the weapons. I was a weapons repairman.
Mm-hmm.
If you had guard duty, sometimes, you know, it depends on what your position was, they got you to do. I know you would pull guard at night. You always worked, was on the perimeter, or we were anyway.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, you didn't do a whole lot. You went out and did your whatever they wanted you to do, like fill sandbags or stand on the perimeter guard duty on that. You always were aware of the rounds coming. You just tried never to get away from your bunker,
mm-hmm.
from a hole in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It was just basically sit and wait. You sat around and shot the bull a lot. Mm-hmm. You stood there, and there might be seven or eight of you together in a trench line watching the perimeter, and that's really what you did.
Right.
Waiting for the big one. They always kept saying the big one. You made sure your weapons were clean.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they'd tell you, well, we're going to get hit really hard
mm-hmm.
tonight. And you'd just sit there and wait for the, you know, you figure, God, I hope the sun comes up in the morning. Hope I'm around.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it would be, they would build you up and get you so psyched up. And then when it didn't happen, it was such a letdown.
Really?
Oh, it was, you know, you're psyched up. You're ready to go. And, you know, whether you live or die, you know, this is it. And you're tensed up. You're just, there's no way you can sleep. And, adrenaline's flowing, and you're just ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you just hope you make it. And you try to route, you know, you sit there in your bunker, and you route your escape plan in case something, you start getting overrun. You just silly things like that. And then all of a sudden the sun comes up and nothing. And you're sitting there. Even though you may have gotten killed and it may have been one hellacious battle, it's kind of a letdown. Because you've trained and your coach gets you all psyched up for this football game or mm-hmm. basketball game. And you're ready to go and nothing happens.
Right.
You never go out. And the game doesn't come off,
right?
No matter how terrible it might be. And that happens several times. You know, you get yourself all psyched up, and they would get you psyched up. You know, they'd come around and say, we got 22,000 NVA, and we've out in front of you, and it's going to be a big one. And then nothing would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, I honestly think it would have happened if it hadn't been for the air.
Really?
For the mm-hmm. Air Force and the Marines and the Navy pilots, mm-hmm. they were outstanding,
mm-hmm.
and they're the ones that saved their butt. I really believe, firmly believe, it would have been one bad incident, bad accident. It would have been a bad one. It could have really been a bad battle, and we could have easily got our ass wiped out if it wasn't for that.
What about drug and alcohol use? How much did you witness of that?
Didn't see very much of Quezon, especially. Alcohol was darn near non-existent to us. When the first air cav came in, now we didn't have any type of booze, especially after the siege started.
Mm-hmm.
There was like a little club, and you got these ration cards, and it's about like World War. Don't remind me of World War II when you got your rations.
Mm-hmm.
You had the ration cards, and they'd stamp them, or they'd punch them, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get two beers, or something like that, and they'd stamp it. But once the siege began, unless somebody went on R&R and brought something back,
mm-hmm.
you'd very seldom did you ever see it. I can't remember ever seeing it. The drugs, same way. I personally never was around that much drugs, and I know it had to have been there.
Right.
I don't think there was any hard stuff. I think there was marijuana, and it was mainly guys that had gone on R&R and gotten out of that area, and they'd
mm-hmm.
come back with some.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do it, so I didn't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't really around that many guys that was. Now, when the first air cab, like I was saying, when they came in, it was like a whole different world, because the first air cab had, for one thing, the first air cab has more helicopters
right.
than all the Marine Corps. At the time,
mm-hmm.
We were a very small outfit, and most of our stuff was Korean War. It was held together with duct tape and baling wire, it seemed like. And they come in there with these brand new helicopters and Cobras. We'd always heard about the Cobra gunships, and we'd never
mm-hmm.
seen them. And they just come in there, and it was like we were like kids, country kids coming into the big city. We just sat there in awe of all the firepower these guys had.
Mm-hmm.
And now the one thing is about the booze, they brought in, they had underneath there, they would bring in pallets of beer.
Hmm.
They had them in the nets hanging underneath the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'd gone for like months and months without anything alcoholic to drink. And the first thing these guys do, they bring in the booze. We couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And our captain, and we had some first air cadets next to us, and they offered us beer. Our captain said no.
Hmm.
Our captain, I guess, was a teetotaler or RCO,
mm-hmm.
and he wouldn't let us have it. And they were only going to give us like two beers per man.
Right.
And I guess he was afraid we was all going to get drunk or something. We couldn't, so we had to sit there and watch those guys drink.
I'm sure that wasn't very fun.
Oh, no, we were very mad. We were really mad.
Right.
If the CO would have been in the right place, somebody probably would have shot him on that one, because we'd been there sitting there getting a beating
mm-hmm.
for 77 days, and then finally somebody was going to give us some beer, and
mm-hmm.
no. It made you feel, you know, like you couldn't be trusted.
Right.
You know, after all this time, after all we went through, and all he wanted to do was give us two beers.
Right.
And so, yeah, the first air cabinet is almost, in a way, we didn't like it because we thought they had some guys, they had some guys wounded laying there on a stretcher, and their first priority was getting the beer in
mm-hmm.
before they got the wounded out. It seemed like that to us, and we're saying, you know, you got your priorities a little screwed up. You
mm-hmm.
got guys laying there wounded, need to be medevaced. Instead, you got crates of beer coming in.
Was this kind of a rivalry between the Army and the Marine Corps, do you think?
Oh, yeah.
That played into it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And when the, the Marine Corps and Army never got along. The Army had the best gear as compared to us. Now, I think nowadays it's pretty well evened out. You know, it's not like that anyway. But we were like the redheaded stepchild, the Marine Corps was. Anything the Army didn't want, we would get. And the Army always got the better clothing. They had more equipment. Like, you couldn't believe how much equipment these guys had. You know, we'd wear clothes until they darn near rotted off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like they always had nice-looking utilities, new jungle utilities and stuff. And their rifles would look really nice, and ours would look like something, you know. they threw away, and we got them.
Right.
They had more ammunition. Their equipment was better. Their rations were better.
Right.
You know, we were eating stuff from the Korean War, and they had all the newest stuff. We always took kind of, in a way, after a while, we took great pride, because the Marine Corps did the same with less.
Right.
You know, we did as much, if not more, with less. And so we lost more people. Percentage-wise, the Marine Corps lost more people than the Army did. And after us, sick as it sounds, after a while, the Marine Corps took great pride in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. I guess they thought that we were catching more than they did.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't like the Army too well.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays it's different. I'm sure the feeling's different, but
mm-hmm.
I would hope it is. But yeah, we were always. I guess it was, in a way, it was envy.
Right.
But we thought they were a bunch of. You know, we thought we were tougher. We always did think the Marine Corps always does. They psychologically, Marine Corps, they're pretty good on psyching you out, thinking you're the best thing there's going.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, you are. When it comes right down to it.
Let me ask you, mentioned kind of jokingly about shooting the CO a little while ago. What did you ever hear any talk about fragging?
Yeah, I've heard talk about it.
Right.
And it wasn't just, we had a First Sergeant, what was his name? I think it was First Sergeant Robinson. And he was a real tall black guy. Really, I liked the guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he stuttered, but he was hardcore. And, you know, he didn't take any lip. And some of the black guys didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest of us, we thought he was okay because you know, he'd tell you to do something, you knew you better do it or else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the black guys took offense to it because he wasn't a brother.
Right.
Basically what it was. You know, they thought he should be a brother, and he was a Marine, or he was a brother. That's the way he looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe somebody, when he was on a crapper, I'm not sure about this, but I think it happened. I'm pretty sure it did happen. I think he was on a crapper, and somebody rolled a grenade in, and they forgot to pull the pin.
Oh.
Now, I don't know if they forgot to pull the pin or it was just a warning,
mm-hmm.
you know, and But yeah, I think I shook him up a little bit. I mean, he'd come out of there mad. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it was the black guys. Some of the black guys really took offense to him because they thought he should be more black than Marine.
Right.
And he wasn't. He was a Korean War vet. He'd gotten wounded in Korea, so he'd been around.
Right.
And he was a good man. He was a good man.
Did you ever witness any racial issues?
Not really. Now, when Martin Luther King got killed, mm-hmm. I remember that. It was almost, you know, they announced it. I don't know how we found out, but it, somehow or other it came over that Martin Luther King got killed. And all the black guys, and they kind of went off to themselves. And we, you know, we didn't say anything to them. And they went off to themselves and had their little powwow, whatever they were doing, talking about it. And mm-hmm. and after a while, it probably lasted a couple of hours. And after that, it was business as usual. Mm-hmm. Now, I know it did happen in some outfits, especially Army, because Army had draftees. And draftees is different than the Marine Corps. For the most part, we were volunteers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we knew what we were getting into. And so if you volunteer for something, you're less likely to have problems than if you're forced to do something.
Right.
And I think the Army had a lot more racial problems than we did. Now, they're towards the end, though. I do remember we were getting some pretty radical black guys in.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming out of, like, New Jersey or the inner city, Detroit, mm-hmm. and that area. And they were pretty well racist. And we had racist white guys. You know, you had some guys from down south that were, you know, pretty hardcore racist guys.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I would say no, we didn't. It was a good outfit. As far as that goes, as far as everybody getting along, everybody seemed to get along, had a good time. Mexican, blacks, Puerto Ricans, white guys, all seemed to get along.
How about keeping up with news from the United States? You said you mentioned you got the news of Martin Luther King. What about keeping up with what was happening back on the domestic front?
Only if through the Stars and Stripes, which would get every once in a while in the newspaper,
mm-hmm.
and if somebody would send you clippings. Mm-hmm. About that, or if you got some new guy in, he went on R&R or something like that, you'd get some information. But for the most part, we were pretty ignorant about what was going on.
Right. How much contact did you have with home?
I called home one time from R&R, and that was only for 3 minutes.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't allow us to, where I was, they wouldn't allow us to talk over 3 minutes, but that was it. Some mail.
Right.
Mail, and that was it.
How often did you write?
Well, I try to write at least every 2 or 3 days, but I don't know if... And they, for the most part, got it. I think they got most of it. We didn't get our mail very often, but they, like I think I told you before, sometimes the mail got blown up. And a lot of times it got blown up, or if it'd be on a plane, it got shot down, burn up,
mm-hmm.
something like that. Mm-hmm. Helicopter got shot down. So our mail was pretty sporadic. We didn't get it real often, but yeah, we did pretty good considering, I guess.
Tell me about your R&R.
R&R was great. I went to Bangkok, Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
I took it. You're supposed to be there about 6 months before you're allowed to go.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd been there, I guess, in the country about 4 months, and I had a chance to go. And I didn't want to go any place... like Australia or Hawaii. I didn't want to go any place where there's round eyes, white people. You know, we call them round eyes.
Right.
Because that would just make me homesick. And I didn't want to do it. Probably should have gone to Australia. Everybody went there and said it was great. But
uh-huh.
still, I just didn't want to do it. And the farthest I wanted to do was see a round-eyed woman and have to leave.
And right.
So I stayed with the Asian. And so I got to go to Bangkok, and I thought, well, if I do this now, I got 9 more months to go. I'm going to really be mad. But I thought, I thought I was going to get killed, especially with a case on.
Mm-hmm.
So I just grabbed it. I thought, I'm going to have a good time while I can.
Mm-hmm.
So I took it and had a good time. Went to Bangkok. It was 5 days, I believe, four nights. And you flew out of Khe Sanh down to Da Nang, and you spent a day, and of course you looked like crap, especially where we were, because you could always tell the guys that were up Khe Sanh, because we were always covered with red. You even got to the point where your skin, there was a red dust or the red clay,
mm-hmm.
and all your clothing was just kind of a reddish tint, even though you had green uniforms. Your skin was started to turn almost reddish, and you just looked like crap. You really did. And when I got to Da Nang, I had a real good friend I grew up with, Dane Hubanks, and Dane was in the Marine Air Wing. So I had a day or two before I was supposed to fly out. So I hopped on the back of a little motorcycle with an Arvin. And for a carton of cigarettes, he took me right to where Dane was. I told him what the address was, and I had to go into PX and buy him a carton of Cools. We had Cools or Salem's. One of the menthols, because that's what they always smoked, the menthol. I believe it was Salem's. And for a carton of Salem's, he said, I'll take you to this place. Good enough. So I went in and bought him a carton of Salem's and gave it to him and hopped on the back, and he took me right to the gate, to the Marine Air Wing gate. And so then I had to go find Dane. I found him. And he looked at us, and of course I'd grown up with the guy, and he looked at me, and he just about cried. He couldn't believe, you know, what I looked like, because I look like Joe Shit the Ragman. You know, I'm covered, my utilities are all ripped, and I got a rifle, and it looks like crap. And the Air Wing is like, Marine Air Wing is like being in the Air Force up here in the Marine Corps. They had really nice equipment and mess halls and all this stuff, And so I went there, and we went to the club and drank, and of course their guys, the nice thing about being from Quezon, if they found out where you're from, then they would buy you drinks, so you get drink all night, didn't cost you a cent.
Right.
But then the next day I went, caught a flight to Bangkok, and of course when you land, they take you into the hangar. You got all branches of the service there. And they give you this pep talk about VD and what you shouldn't do and what you should. And they give you pass out condoms, which everybody really threw in the trash can after. But they gave you this pep talk about what you shouldn't do and where you shouldn't go and what girls don't touch. It was basically you just went there and drank and you got laid. That was the sole purpose of it. And that's what you did for 5 days. Except for the guys that were married. Some of the guys that were married, they wouldn't do it. But the rest of us were young and single and figured we weren't going to live much longer anyway. So.
Right.
So, yeah. But there, R&R was good. You can go to, there was several places you could go. Hong Kong, I know in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, I believe it was in Malaysia. You could go to Guam. Go to Okinawa, go to Japan, Singapore. Singapore. And then there's Australia and Hawaii. Hawaii was mainly for the married guys.
Right.
You could go, but we tried to keep it for the married guys because their wives, they'd meet their wives there.
Right.
But, it was a good deal. And some guys, well, now Marine Corps, we only got it once while you're there, but I know, talked to several Army guys that, they went 3 and 4 times. It's just, that's one other reason why we didn't like the Army. They just seemed to always have things better than we did.
Right. When you got back to Quezon, were you refreshed? Had it helped you?
Yeah, I was real well. When I landed in Da Nang from Bangkok, I went and saw my buddy again because the monsoon had set in and Quezon was socked in. You couldn't fly into it, so that was really good for me. So that gave me an extra day there in Da Nang. So I just went and found my hometown buddy there, and we went and had a good time, talked and drank, and talked about family and guys. And I really hated this. When I left him, I thought it was going to be the last time I would see him. I really thought I wasn't going to make it.
Did he survive the war?
Oh, yeah, Dane. Yeah, he just lives about 20 miles north of me. Yeah, he's fine.
You guys still in touch?
Yeah. Okay. I see him quite often. Like I say, he was in the Air Wing, so it was like being in the Air Force. So he didn't have he didn't have as bad. He spent, I think he was only there like 6 months. He went over in the squadron. He was a jet mechanic. And so when the squadron left, they went to Japan, so he spent, I think they spent 6 months in Vietnam and then 6 months in Japan, and then they came home. So the Air Wing was a lot different. It was a whole different world.
Right.
And so we weren't, it's just different. But I really hated to leave him because I thought this is my last touch from you know, from home, my last thing from home, and I know when I leave here, I may not see anybody again, so.
Right.
So I really hated to go, but I knew I had to.
Right.
So when we flew in, and when you fly in the caisson system, leaving and flying in, leaving caisson and going in is just unbelievably terrifying. It took more nerve to leave than it did to stay. But and the only reason I left because I thought this is my only chance. But
can you describe that to me?
Well, you'd lay there by the. Well, if you're trying to leave, you lay there in a trench by the airstrip because you never stood, you never sat around because the rounds come and they're always trying to shell the airstrip. And when a plane or a helicopter would land, it's just unbelievable. They had that thing zeroed in and they would drop mortars right on top of it, and mortars would land all over the airstrip. So if you're loading or unloading. You didn't walk, that's for sure. You just ran for everything it was worth. And a lot of times, they'd never shut the engines down. And sometimes, with the planes especially, they wouldn't even stop. They would just lower the ramp and kind of taxi rather quick down the airstrip. And you'd run.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd dive on the back, and the crewman would be there pulling you. If you were a slow runner, you just didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have to run, you know, the plane take off. You'd be standing out there. So you would run back and dive in a trench and wait for something else to come in, or you may have to wait the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Same way when you landed, you know, because it's shrapnel all over the place, and these guys would get killed trying to get out and coming in. And you just jumped off that thing and just ran for all it was worth.
Mm-hmm.
You never walked. Because if you walked, you were sitting duck. And I had a good friend, Manny Babbitt. He didn't get killed, but he was running across the airstrip and a round come in, and he got hit. He got medevaced. I saw him get hit, but I didn't know it was Manny at the time. I just knew there was a guy running across the airstrip, and we was kind of watching him because we thought, wow, this is not real smart.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, it was Manny, and rounds come roaring in there, he got hit. He got hit in the head and the hand. He got three places.
Mm-hmm.
Got hit in the head and the hand. And I'm not sure. I believe it might have been the arm.
Mm-hmm.
And he went down. They had a medevac. He came back. Unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, he wasn't bad enough to get out of there permanently.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what would you say was the bravest action you witnessed while in Vietnam?
Oh, by all means, the corpsmen. I've always said that.
Right.
The corpsmen were the you know, the bravest people I've ever met.
Uh-huh.
As far as a group of people goes. There are so many acts of heroism. It's just hard to describe, narrow it down to one outside of a corpsman, I've always said that from the moment I've been around corpsmen.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, guys, you know, under fire, going out and saving, trying to drag people in, help carry them in there. And it got to be, you don't want to say routine, but it was just something that was expected of you.
Right.
If someone got, you know, if they got caught out there, you just tried not to ever leave them, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you always look at it your way. If it's you out there getting the hell blown out of you, you want somebody to come and help you. So that's the way you looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be pretty fatalistic. If it's, you know, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And, you know, if I'm supposed to get killed, I'll get killed. So if I'm not, I'll make it. And you just run out there and you do it. And
right.
I watch that happen a lot. And so, yeah, to me that's one of the greatest things, just trying to survive that place to
mm-hmm.
balls.
Mm-hmm. Is there a humorous event that stands out in your mind?
Is there what?
A humorous event that stands out in your mind when you think back?
Yeah, it seems like I think I wrote in one of them. One of the things I wrote about one of the guys got his got hit in the testicles,
uh-huh.
and he got. I think he lost one,
uh-huh.
and of course they medevaced him. Of course we kind of chuckled about it, laughed at it because you know, he was okay, really. Of course, you know, nobody wants to get hit. That's two things you worried about the most to getting hit. It was your groin area and your eyes.
Uh-huh.
The rest of it you could. You could almost live with. If you lost an arm or leg or something like that, you could pretty well survive that and be okay. You could deal with it more mentally.
Right.
But if you lost your things that you worried about the most. Well, he got one of his nuts blown off.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we were laughing our head off after he got medevaced, you know.
Right.
Of course, and kind of chuckled at the time after we figured out he wasn't going to die. And we medevaced him. And sure enough, he come back about a month or so later.
Uh-huh.
And,
did you guys give him a hard time?
Oh, yeah. And he even laughed about it.
Uh-huh.
And, but, yeah, we thought it was funny. Yeah, he didn't see the humor in it at first, but we did. And so after a while, he started joking, what nothing to do about it, and said, live with it. So he was okay.
Uh-huh.
Now, we didn't, you know, every once in a while, some guy would lose it. And, you know, that's the first thing you grab, first thing you check if you're in an explosion or something like that.
Uh-huh.
First thing you do is go down there and check and make sure that's okay, and check your eyes. Kind of blink those and make sure you got those. And
uh-huh.
rest of it's secondary compared to those.
Right.
But, yeah, guys would get hit in the groin area, and it, either get shot off or blown off sometimes.
How long were you actually at Quezon?
Oh, I was there over 6 months. I got there just before Christmas of 67, I'd say about a week before Christmas, so it would have been about the 20th or of December.
Right.
And I left in one of the last convoys in like the 5th of July.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in April when the siege is over, they were supposed to, most of the infantry left, and I was in Ontos, and a lot of most of the artillery, and the mortars and all those guys, they left.
Mm-hmm.
But Ontos was kind of a bastard outfit. We were attached to tanks to a tank because I think I told you before, they disbanded the Ontos.
Yes, sir.
And the only reason we were still up there is because we couldn't get out. So those of us in Ontos, they didn't really know what to do with us.
Mm-hmm.
So they left us there. And so everybody else left, and now it was probably about the third week, fourth week of April. We stayed until July.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody else that came in there was pretty much new.
Right.
And we were one of the oldest outfits still there. And when the 1st Air Cav left, they occupied, our infantry left, and then the 1st Air Cav came in and occupied their bunkers. Well, I'm sure we had done some stuff to them. You know, when the Army left, they booby-trapped, they had tear gas grenades and stuff like that, and they would kind of booby-trap, and so when the Marines could move back in, some new Marines would move in those bunkers, and the tear gas grenades would go off.
Right.
A lot of them crapped right in the middle of the bunkers and left it there. So for the guys come in there, you know, we weren't real happy with 1st Air Cav.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, we witnessed all this because we were the old and the new. You know, we were there with the old and we was there with the new.
Uh-huh.
And so we didn't really particularly care for the 1st Air Cav because, you know, we thought they were really kind of disappointed. We were disappointed with it. To me, they looked like more like a Boy Scout troop when they come roaring in there. They come in there all bunched up and they had rifles just hanging off them. And they weren't, to me, they didn't. To us, they just didn't look professional. Like we'd always heard the 1st Air Cav was a great outfit, and we was going to see something really big. And we were really disappointed. And so they kind of booby-trapped a lot of stuff, and not where anybody would get killed, but, you know, tear gas grenades going off and stuff like that.
Right.
So, it wasn't great. So we didn't care for them at all.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. And it was probably a lot of rivalry, and they thought we were, you know, they looked at us like we were, they couldn't believe how we had lived. Because if you looked, when they came in there, there was shrapnel laying all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And you look like crap because the way your skin looked because of all the red clay and the dust, and your clothes just looked terrible. And everybody kind of had this strange look in their eyes, and, you know, and they ask us, you know, are you okay? And we said, yeah, we're okay. And they say, are you sure you're okay? Yeah, we're okay. You know, we didn't know any different. And I guess to them, we just looked like something out of a horror movie, I guess, the
mm-hmm.
way we looked.
Mm-hmm.
To us, that's just the way we lived. We'd been that way for so long, we didn't know any different.
Right. So where did you go in July?
Left there, we took a convoy out, and before we left, we had to tear down every bunker. Mm-hmm. We had to take a knife to every sandbag and every barrel that had dirt in it. We had to empty all of them, and CBs, or the Marine engineers, one of the two, they dug trenches, and all the barrels we had to line up, and a tank would, after we emptied them, and the tank would go down and flatten every one of them, and then we'd throw those in the big ditch. Any vehicle that wouldn't run, the engineers would dig a big enough ditch, a hole that you could just shove the vehicle in, and you just left it, and you buried it. And when we left, the place was flattened. There wasn't anything above ground.
Right.
And so we got in a convoy, and we really thought, I think the last night we were there, there was like, you know, we at the height of the siege, there was like 6,000 Marines plus Army and Arvin. And when we left, there's like 300 or 400 Marines left on the base, and we just figured, God, we're going to get slaughtered. You know, they could come in here and just whack us easy. So the last night we were there was pretty hairy as far as, you know, thinking that we, you know, thinking they could attack us easy with a company and, you know, with a battalion and pretty well do us in.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily nothing happened. They threw some rounds in on us, but that wasn't anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in a convoy, and we drove out. We drove to Camlo,
mm-hmm.
which is the first village probably out that you would come to outside on Route 9 going back to the Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there, and we stopped there, and we, you know, we were just so thrilled to get out of that place. And because it was scary getting out of there, because you had to go through there's a lot of junk vegetation on both sides of the road, and you just knew you were going to get ambushed. And so you would... most of us that were in trucks. Now, I was in a truck, and I was in a man in a 50 caliber machine gun, and one of those, I don't know what you call it, but they're on a ring. You're in the cab.
Mm-hmm.
It's on a ring, and you stand in the middle, and you can swivel it around.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go 360 degrees. And so I was manning that. And then on the six-bys, which is a big pickup or the big trucks that we had, mm-hmm. they were lined with the bottom was lined with probably two or three layers of sandbags for if you hit a mine. And then the guys would sit on those, and you faced, you know, outward,
mm-hmm.
and you just waiting to get ambushed and hoping it didn't happen. And luckily, we made it out of there. It surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised there wasn't that much. There was sniper fire, and every once in a while some poor guy get hit. But, you know, we were so thrilled to get out of that place that we were willing to run the gauntlet, try to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we got out. And then we went to Camlo,
mm-hmm.
and we stayed there because of, once again, they didn't know what to do with us. We stayed at Camlo for a couple of days until they figured out what to do with our outfit. You know, we had all these Hontos sitting around. We had all these Marines sitting around, and they didn't have a place to put us.
Mm-hmm.
They finally took us to Quang Tri. No, we went to Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Dong Ha, spent a night there in a tank outfit, and got in a big-ass brawl.
You did? Or?
Well, the whole, yeah, it was tankers against Hontos.
Uh-huh.
And what it was, we thought we were salty. You know, we thought we was bad because we'd just come out of Quezon. So we went in there. We went into the club, and we thought we was badasses. And we didn't go by the rules. You know, you're supposed to take your cover off, and we kind of crowded in front of everybody. And so pretty soon, you know, it started going at it. And so pretty soon, it was a big-ass brawl.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a... Hontos against the tankers. It lasted for a while.
How'd you do?
I got knocked out.
Got knocked out?
I'd like to say I kicked a lot of butt, but it didn't happen.
Do you remember what happened?
Yeah, I remember. I was running around I was chasing a tanker around a tank. And some guy in the tank lowered the tube,
uh-huh.
lowered the gun just as I come around there, and I ran right into it and knocked myself out. And so I don't know if I was chasing him. I think I was chasing one guy, and two of them was chasing me. So we were going around the tank. But before that, we got it. You know, we got in some few licks. It was kind of the first sergeant. I still remember him, First Sergeant Robinson. He was standing up there on the. Of course, he loved it. He just thought it was great. Uh-huh. And he set up on top of a bunker, and he had this. He always carried a big swagger stick. It was made out of a 50 caliber. Bar. It's probably about 18 inches long, or maybe 24 inches long. And on one end was a 50 caliber bullet, and the projectile. And on the end of it was a the 50 caliber casing. Uh-huh. And I think it was like brass. He had it bronzed or something like that. And he always carried that thing. It looked like General Patton walking around that thing.
Uh-huh.
And he'd if he wanted your attention, he'd just thump you on the head with that thing.
Uh-huh.
And I still remember First Sergeant Robinson. He'd stand up there, and if somebody went by, one of the tankers. Went by, he'd just lean over and just hit this guy right in the head. Just damn near knock him out. And then he'd just sit back up and just laugh. And he'd watch the rest of it.
Uh-huh.
He never got it, did anything except sit up there and laugh and just hit somebody with that swagger sticker uh-huh. once in a while. But yeah, I got knocked out, so I don't remember anything until I woke up about an hour later, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But there was, and of course we got chewed out and everything, but
right.
they didn't do anything.
Right.
And tankers wanted us out of there, so the next day they sent us down to Klang Tree, which is about, I guess it's about 10 or 15 miles south of there.
Mm-hmm.
And they put us next to a, once again, they had no idea what to do. They stuck us, we were with a tank outfit, a tank headquarters, and they stuck us next to a rice paddy on the very edge of a rice paddy and gave us some tents and said, here, go at it. So we had to put the tents up and go out and steal all the plywood and everything. We had to steal practically.
Uh-huh.
You know, we'd find where the Army was, and we'd make raids at night and go steal plywood and stuff from there.
Right.
And, of course, then when the monsoons hit later on, everything we had went underwater practically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why they put us there, really. They knew it was going to, when it hit, it was going to flood.
Uh-huh.
That's why there wasn't anybody there, because
uh-huh.
they were too smart. So, yeah, it was. Then we spent from Klang Tree, that was our home base, and then I went to like Con Tin, Camp Carroll, just kind of bounced around different
uh-huh.
places working on weapons. So I didn't stay in the rear that often. You know, maybe 1 week out of the month I would be in the rear for a total of a week maybe. And rest time I'd be out in the field working on the weapons or something like
right.
that.
Right. So would you go out by yourself or would you go out with a few other men?
For the most part it would be me. I would go out, they would come and get me or I'd fly out. There were just wasn't that many weapons armors,
mm-hmm.
and so and I liked it out there. It wasn't to me being in the rear was just a lot of chicken shit.
Uh-huh.
It was a lot of inspections, and you had to look really neat and snap, and you had to salute. And
right.
It was just I just didn't like it, and mm-hmm. I felt more comfortable away from the rear, so I was more comfortable out in the field
mm-hmm.
with the guys. It just it wasn't you know. Surviving was better out there than putting up with the crap in the
mm-hmm.
rear.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we take a break for a moment, sir?
Okay.